friends who's got a birthday today. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, Rama. Welcome,
Thank
everybody.
Thank you, Lady Master.
I think that knocked up the tonal somewhere.
It did.
I mean, it just brought memories, but that sure does date the thing, doesn't it?
It does.
Oh, it's strong, but that was me. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I was just asking, Rama, what's your favorite song?
Oh, I would say it's The Voice by Celtic Woman.
That's a very cool song.
Along with Yes, Close to the Edge.
That's a good one, too.
It is.
And I know you know that. What's that song? From Lion King.
Yeah. Oh. Can you feel the love?
That one's called The Circle of Life.
Yeah.
Can't You Feel the Love Tonight? I think that's the one right before it.
Yeah.
It's when Simba and
Nala.
Yeah. Find each other.
Oh.
Yes.
That's such a sweet time.
Yeah.
It that is. Was my oldest child's first movie in the theaters.
Oh, my.
And he was so little that every time a loud noise came, he kind of went down under the seat. Hi, everybody. If you didn't know, today is Rama's birthday, and I had just told Tara and Rama moments before that I was playing the Obama songs.
I know. She was kidding me. Well, we're going to play something that has a connection with Obama that's called it's called NASA. You got it right there, Rama?
Yeah.
NASA Kennedy Obama connection to 2012. And this is a 2-hour and 50-minute round of Dr. Richard Hoagland.
And he's laying it out in lavender with what is happening right now with the dark rift. To be explicit, Mother's Yanni. And I will just say that what is happening is, in fact, he talks about it, 11-11-2012, December 21st. At that time frame, you could say that you have all your ducks in the row. And the chips are going to fall as they may. And it's about the issue here. We are one race. It is called humanity with the colors of the rainbow. And that is the biggest deal that's going on in terms of hard news, if you want me to start, Dad.
Beth? Did we lose Beth?
I don't know. I think, are you there? Oh.
I wonder what happened to...
Oh.
Oh, Beth is not here. Please call Beth. Help, help, help.
Yeah, and I guess I will talk about the hard news. Okay. Well, everybody, what's happening as we are seeing it by the good folks, Lawrence O'Donnell and Rachel Meadows and Stephanie Miller and Keith Olbermann are saying these guys called the Republican, and I have heard people equate the Republican Party with the word fascist today, along with Nazis, along with other harsh words. And I would just like to say, as Jesse Ventura puts it, you know, no party. How about the People's Party? There used to be something in the 60s called the People's Party, and Wavy Gravy was part of that. I just remember that. But Bernie Sanders is an independent, and I would follow Bernie Sanders' lead. This man knew knows Ted Kennedy. I was speaking in past, but the man is still here waiting in the wings to give his story. And like we have all heard about JFK, he is here. He's just waiting in the wings, too, and I mean senior. And just like, you know, the Grand Dragon, Mr. Shirk, Jr., all of these stories have to come out about all of the families who have committed, it's beyond treason, that's the word. And I would highly suggest everybody go to MSNBC.com and listen to Keith Olbermann's special comment. It says it so well. This is why I said when I started, this is about one story. Humanity has all colors. We are all the rainbow rays of living light. And it has to do with that in terms of how we have first contact, and this is the key right now that we are being given, and you might say we're being whopped upside the head with the 2x4 because it's about the issue called race. We are one race. We are called love. It is the colors of the rainbow. Mother does not create any life forms except love. And it comes in all forms, whether it swims or it flies or it walks and it talks like me. And I will just say that what is being taught here on such a high level, yet it's gotten nitty gritty and down to it. And the tea baggers do not represent what the real Boston Tea Party even remotely resembles. And I mean, I heard Mike Malloy the other night, in fact it was Monday night, and he, I will just say, Mike Malloy is this side of Howard Stern, yet that's not a bad thing. He is saying it like it is, where these guys need to be on a platter alongside George Bush. And, you know, mother is the chef. I'll put it that way. It is at that level because it is over and we are watching the flailings about of an extremely ancient dying race who are with their gasping breath saying, send me love. And that is what is the order of the day. That's why I'm saying we are all one race. When one heals it, we heal it for the whole. And even if I'm the only one that's saying love these ones right now, because they are in their final throes, and you can see it going on with everything. This is why this good lady, Miss Shirley, was ousted and then brought back and given an apology, and they did it with Acorn as well. Acorn has been around for 40 years and they help people who...
No, they're not gone. They just took a little form shape and they have been really keeping the word out. And
that's right.
If you know what we're doing, we're making lemonade out of a lemon here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even drawing attention even more. People are...
I, if you don't mind, I'd like to make an important point about this.
Yes.
Yes.
This is more, much, much more than about race. Much more. We really need... Go ahead,
yes.
Go ahead.
It's about buying a planet for the highest price going, and you can't buy Mother Earth. She's not for sale.
You were reading my mind, and I'd like to explain it a different way.
Oh, okay.
It's about what Mother said. There's only one sin, and that is poverty,
yeah.
As it gets in the way of another soul on their way home.
Yes.
That's also true. And there's something very important we need to bring out on the calls, because they're not going to talk about it on the news. And this is extremely important. The NAACP has come out. A member emeritus said this today. And there were others that have said this, that they're looking at this from the point of view of being a civil rights issue, and we absolutely right now must stop that, because civil law is not correct law, and we don't, as we look at this as a civil rights issue, we give the power back to the corporation of the United States of America to do our people wrong. Are we the people? They will do us wrong every time if we look at this as a civil rights issue. This is not a civil rights issue. This is a human rights issue. And the only place we can look at those human rights issues as one vote, one nation, is in the United Nations and the ICC. And if they bring up civil rights in this discussion, I will put every word of it down, because I don't want to have a discussion about civil rights. And Malcolm X talked about this back in 1963, I'm guessing. That's before my time. But if I remember my studies right, it was 1963. And he was saying, stop kowtowing to the government, these Dixocrats who have you as slaves. And I'm here to tell you, if you're white in America, you are just as much a slave as long as your birth certificate is still a bond and being traded on the stock market. You are a slave. Every American who's still in that programming is still a slave, no matter what your complexion is. So what Malcolm X was saying 40, 60 years ago was, stop it. Time out. We're not going to fight for our civil rights. We need to start talking about human rights. And that's what the Aboriginal Moabite Nation is about now. We're establishing our rights as one race of humanity. And so all of this talk is kind of wonderful. It's a gift. So now we can start talking about it from a more elevated place, from a spiritual place, and we can talk to each other as one human race. And I don't want to hear anything about civil rights. That's old school, and that's no more. And I don't follow civil law. I follow mother's law.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, when we file our UCC, that is the civil commercial code. And again, it's bigger than that. Because
it's the uniform commercial code, which is based on civil law, which was established back when Caesar of Rome was in the palace.
Yes, and it's bigger than that because it was the insertion of something much more, you might say, surreptitious of religion as a way, as a backdrop. And also remember, Hebrew law is the universal commercial code, and it is the code of commerce for the entire planet.
It's based on Vatican canon code.
Now listen, because of the Moabite Nation, that has become higher law than the Vatican.
That's right. That's
how we did it. This is the same way we're looking at this.
This is why I began it when it said humanity. We are one race.
Right. You're right.
And we have two things, our body and our understanding of the game. Literally, in a beginning, as you take the existing structures, you understand the game and you give the whole thing a different look.
That's right.
And a new use.
That's right.
And in other words, it's the Aikido of it. We're going to do this with flowers. As there's an intention for, let's fight about it, the dance of the Aikido moves with the resistance and lets it flow right beyond him, even through. And that experience has been had by many, where literally it appears like you're going to be not in this dimension anymore. You're heading for a semi-truck, and you literally go right through the vehicle, and you're still here, and you're going on your way. That is what Rama experienced when he saw this wave across the road.
That's right.
And
same waves. And when those ripples go across, it affects matter, living bone. And I'll just tell you that, you know, I watched the car roll, and it literally just went through the wave and rolled. And I watched the time wave go by, and I had already stopped because I was feeling very uncertain about the energies, and I just waited till after the fact, and then I knew it was time to go on. And what is happening right now with this whole issue with Miss Shirley and why this is coming up, and this is what is tied in with what Richard Hoagland has to say here about this man who has taken the commander-in-chief's seat, Indian chief, as I've heard it say. Also, I call him the Syrian commander of the Council of Nine, because that is his title, as I know him from the Galactic Commands. And what I understand about this is that things are moving forward in the understanding that we are creating right now the doorway, and it's already been done in the future, where Earth is the 33rd member of the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds. We are making this form right now. Dr. Jacques Fresco on the Venus Project just gave it out, what him and his beloved are doing across the planet. And this is how we heal it, when we help Mother come into a balance instead of stone and steel and, you know, the way the 9/11 towers were built. And I understand we have to create new ways, and they're already here. Jacques Fresco is giving us the designs that already work. Ed Hicks, who is Enoch, has spherical structures that are ready out of the box to go at the right moment, as Nisara is announced in full disclosure, first contact.
Okay. We are at that doorway.
We are.
And I can feel the cohesiveness of the oneness in connecting and reconnecting with Sekhmet's energy right now. As she comes, as she comes at the beginning and the end of every yuga, and she comes here to bring balance. And out of divine chaos comes balance.
This is where I say watch Jackie Chan. And Jackie Chan is an incredible master with the different martial arts. He can be a fool, but he can walk on air and water. And Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
That's right.
These movies say it all to work with the energies. This is what these folks, the red and the green, the Shaolin masters, the ones that work with Benjamin Fulford of the Oriental world, to use that word.
Yeah.
In the sense, these are our ancient Pleiadian and Syrian and Lyran and Vagan brothers and sisters who are healing this. And all of the Eastern philosophies are based on the sound of one hand clapping, not the other path. And it even goes further than that with Padmasambhava, who was Sanat Kumara, who taught the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha was born in northern Afghanistan. This is the whole area we all decided to play in because we knew when we went through our various circle cycles that we would have to be doing it one last time here. The day at a time as we're approaching it. And
with a full moon, mind you.
Holy shit. Excuse me.
Rama.
I am just saying.
Holy heaven.
Chief said it so well tonight with his special comment about.
Okay, why don't we just listen to Keith? Because this is really. It's only about 10 minutes.
What I grew up with, having an older sister and brother that were both black, who are not here, who are also involved up to their third eyes in this story, and I passed the talking stick.
Let's call on Earl. Hi, Earl.
Well, the news has been really in some weird, odd places.
It's been in good places. We're cleaning this place up, Earl.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you also noticed how NBC and CNN and other news organizations didn't want to jump in with what Fox and this blogger were doing?
Did you say Michelle Bachmann and the blogger?
No, I said CNN and NBC news organizations. They didn't jump in with what Fox was doing. They were taking the approach of, wait a minute, maybe we should look into this more before we weigh in and comment about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I see it that way exactly.
Well, I'll say this, that there is a desperate lunging and pulling, and there is a fiercity on this situation whereby and Rama, I just wonder today, did anybody talk to you about this? Because what's going on is Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, and people on Amy Goodman, and people on keynote addresses. They're all coming here at the same moment, and they're saying, now, what did Richard Holden say? He put it in a nutshell. He said, we're on stage.
Yes.
We are on stage. Now, that doesn't take a hammer and just hammer, you know, on the head of the president.
No.
And as a matter of fact, despite all the expectations of what he's doing, he did a landmark law again.
Yeah.
And he said no more tax dollars to bail out any banks ever. Good night to that one. It's absolute.
If they're too big to exist, they're too big to be here, and, you know.
That is the end of the game. In other words, he didn't challenge anybody. He just made a statement that the people already and the witnessing to what was going on. As it appears that, you know, on certain radio stations, there's a frustration. People are saying, why isn't so-and-so and so-and-so doing what he's supposed to do? Starting with Barack and all, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just coming apart at the seams at the same time.
Let me say this. What's happening is that these ones who want to be in charge know that they're losing ground fast, and they're going to go down. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to create chaos in this way, especially right versus left. And they feel that if they can do this and make a lot of fighting, that maybe they'll get their way, because maybe the Democrats will lose their power if we make them look silly. And I remember what President Obama said at his inauguration when they said, you know, his staff came to him and said, there's trouble. There's people trying to pull off something today to ruin your inauguration. And he looked at them and he said, we are going to turn away from childish things. And you notice he didn't say a word about all this. He has nothing to do with this. Even though they say this is the Obama administration, they like to throw that around because they're trying to start a mud fight and it's not going to work. This had to do with the staff inside the White House who are against the president, who he brought around him so he could make all these changes and keep everything flowing. And so now they're changing the conversation away from being a conversation about race, and they're talking about civil rights, and they're trying to make the NAACP look bad. And Ben Jealous got caught with his pants down yesterday, and it was bad, and it was because he reacted to what the blogger said versus taking an intelligent point from it and taking his time with it. And so that's exactly what they wanted to happen, and now they're going to start conversations about civil rights, and we don't want to go there, because as long as we're talking about civil rights, we're giving power back to the right. And so...
You are correct, Commander.
Thank you.
Yes, it is very important. Yes.
But here's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing certain news organizations starting to make these turnarounds in what they're doing from what they were in the Bush administration.
That's a little bit. You know, Matt Lauer is actually reported the news this morning instead of, you know, commenting on fashion. So, yes, I have seen a slight change in some of the news organizations, like you said. I agree. Things, as we co-create a consensus reality, we're watching change right in front of us. And if it's okay with everybody, I would like to share a message from St. Germain that's talking just about this.
Okay, wait, Beth, can we
and
just
also,
do this?
I found something out about BP where they were manipulating their photos that they were showing on their website of them, like, cleaning up the golf, like, there were some bad Photoshop work.
Uh-huh, yes, I heard about that, Earl.
What was that?
They were playing around with Photoshopping pictures of the golf. So that it would look cleaner than it was.
Oh, that's what they did on 9/11 too, Earl. Very good observation.
Yeah.
They put a blue sky over all of that horrible sky that was in the reality at 9/11 too.
I also heard that they were only cleaning when the photo ops were there, that they weren't cleaning all the time, that they were really shut down from actually cleaning on the beaches except for when they had photo ops. I don't know if that's true, but I have heard that.
I'll just say that thank you, Marita, Robert, and everyone else, Earl, and really it's a very keen clarity that we're all, even the least of our, I know. Okay, same to me. Beth, what about, it's only 10 minutes and I just thought we'd let this piece because Keith, it was a very special thing. And then I think it would be great to go into the Saint Germain after he lays it out.
My feeling is, because I read this, I want us to read Saint Germain first because it's going to change the energy, and then we're going to be looking at what Keith said in different eyes, and that's what I'd like to do. I hear what you're saying, but I have a reason for it.
Okay, that's cool.
You go, Mama.
That's a talking stick.
Thank you. Everybody, I want to introduce this channel. Her name is Alicia Rommel. I have never read anything she's channeled before. I do hear her voice in this channeling, and I strongly hear Saint Germain. And what was said is, it's brilliant. And so please relax and enjoy. This came through Alicia on July 19th. I am beloved Master Teacher Saint Germain, and I come today with a message of awakening. This is an important time on Earth, for she is in her final stages of labor. She is getting ready to push, and with her pushing will come the death of the old world and the birth of the new world. We wish for you to look upon what is happening in this way, for perhaps it will not seem so violent if you do. Giving birth to new life can be painful. In fact, it is what you on Earth expect. You do not believe that giving birth can be easy, yet we assure you it can be. And there was a time, many centuries ago, when it was. However, those days are no more, and you all hold the belief that birth must come with great pain. It is for this reason you are experiencing the transition into higher dimensions with such physical pain in your own bodies. There is always another way, and letting go of what no longer serves you does not need to be painful. However, you do not believe that things can be easy. You hold fast to your belief that life is hard. Truly, it is your belief in suffering that carries you on your journey here on Earth. We come now with a message, and it is that each and every one of you are a midwife to the birth of the new world. You say, how? How can we do anything? We have told you this for many hundreds of years, and we come to you now with the same message today. Love yourself. Look within yourself and heal yourself. When you discover who you are, your vibration will shift and raise to a higher state of consciousness. When you raise your own personal vibration, you raise the vibration of the whole, and this includes Mother Earth, beloved Lady Gaia. The time of a critical mass is drawing close, dear one. And while it would seem that you are to put your focus and attention on the world of all its problems, that is not what you are to do. We know this, in and of itself, will cause some of you to shudder and question the validity of this message. But if you truly understand the world you are living in and the power you have, you will know this is truth. The world you are seeing with your eyes is not real. It's an illusion. You must get this soon, dear ones. The time is critical for this lesson to be learned. The world you see is a projection of your own mind. And the thoughts you think are what you see in your world. The power you possess is in your mind. The war you are fighting is not of the physical. It is not over material possessions or of an earthly nature. The war is in your mind. Your mind is the battlefield, and your emotions are the ammunition. Please understand this. This message is vital for tipping the scales in the favor of love and light. You are being attacked at a mental level by thoughts and images projected at you as mind bombs of fear. Your mind and your emotions are what is at stake here, and they are using your own thoughts and emotions as ammunition to destroy you. Your world will be born anew, and she will exist for you on another plane of higher consciousness. But unless you personally raise your thoughts and emotions to meet her, you will be left here. This is not to scare you. This is to let you know that you are not fighting against BP. You are not fighting to save the Gulf. That is not where you should focus your attention, beloved ones. That is the distraction they want you to focus on. Your focus of attention should always be on your heart. Your power is in your heart. Your quote-unquote bombs are of love. Your holy land is in your own mind. You must protect your minds from the images and thoughts being thrown at you from every level and angle. We are here to help you. And in order for you to know what you are to do, you must know what you are, quote, fighting for, and what your, quote, ammo is. You are fighting for the freedom to think and use your mind as you wish. And you are fighting with a higher vibrational energy than they are, love. Because the world you see is just a reflection of your mind and the collective mind. To change what you see, you must change your mind. This requires you to use your power to say no to all that is not in alignment with your higher self. Your God self, your heart. You do not have to do as you are told. You are more powerful than you know. But you will not find your power until you start to exert some divine will in your decision making. It does not feel good at the level of the heart and soul. Do not do it. This is the beginning. You must understand you have a choice. You must understand that you have the power to experience your world as you want to see it. You have all been brainwashed into believing that you have no power. You have all of the power. This is not a message that we have come with before. We are raising the intensity of our message to match the intensity that is being raised from the other side. While it is true in the ultimate reality, there is no, quote, other side, for in a state of unity consciousness, duality no longer exists. We are speaking to you at the level you are currently on. Unless you have transcended the illusion of duality, in your 3D reality, where, quote, good and bad still exist in the mind, there are some who are desperate for the control of your mind, emotion, and life force. And those who believe in this duality are the most vulnerable to their control and domination. These unconscious controllers are absent of love and are fueled by all the negative emotions fed to them by the mass mind. We want you to understand that you are continually fueling them by fearing them. These people are in power because you have given them power over you. You have since decided you have no way out of this hell on earth. You do. Your mind is your way out. Your heart is the pathway to the higher realms of love and joy, compassion and beauty. If you make the decision to focus on your own heart and set your intention to align your mind with the mind of Christ, you will see that you are helped immediately, dear ones. You have free will. You cannot intervene. We cannot intervene where we are not requested. And we cannot do for you what you must do to what you must learn to do for yourselves. That is your lesson here. We will help and assist you in all ways possible, but cannot interfere with your soul's lesson. You are not calling out to us nearly as often as much as we would like. We cannot come in until we are requested, and you must give up any thoughts about us being bothered by your unqualified request. There is no such thing at this point in time. Many times we have used this analogy, but it is simple, and it cannot be more simple, so that everyone can understand. Imagine you are looking in a mirror. You see a reflection of yourself in the mirror. The reflection shows a pimple on your face. Now, upon seeing this pimple, do you reach to the mirror and try to pick at it? No. You address the sore where it exists, on your face. The reflection is simply showing you what is coming from within you. The same is true for the world you live in and see around you. Some things are completely personal to you because they are an animated expression or reflection of your own mind, or there is something traumatic and catastrophic that is happening on a global scale, such as the Gulf oil spill. You may say, I didn't create that. I didn't have any such thoughts about the Gulf or oil spills before that happened. The truth of the matter is that the collective mind is the catch-all for all the negative thoughts and emotions you send out. And if the mass mind is collectively negative about being powerless to the oil tycoons, then yes, you did help to manifest this disaster. The first step to healing is taking responsibility for what you have contributed. Whether that is constantly complaining every time you fill your gas tank, or whether you have to sacrifice some recreation because gas prices have made you poor, all of it expands in your reality the more you focus on illusion. Energy flows where attention goes. This is a simple enough law to understand and live by, isn't it? Yes, it requires discipline of the mind, and an earnest desire to live a life that you have co-created with source energy. But, dear ones, this is your power. While you must address the effect, you must not put all your attention and focus there. Cleaning up the Gulf is much, much different than focusing more damaging amounts of negative energy back into the collective mind by hating BP and those focused on destroying the earth. You think you are being proactive for change by hating what is in front of you. But the law of attraction is here to teach you that what you hate or send energy to, no matter what the vibration, you are calling for in your experience. You are not helping beloved Gaia by sending hateful thoughts and emotions to people you feel are the villains. You are not victims, dear children. You are the co-creators. As soon as you realize this, you will have made a tremendous shift in your consciousness. You must control your thoughts and emotions. The law of attraction was not introduced into your thought stream so that you could use it to manifest more material possessions and fulfill your greedy and selfish ways. The law of attraction was introduced into your mental streams of consciousness so you could harness the power of it to change your world and use it not for personal gain, but for global abundance and ascension. Materialism is what the old program would want you to use it for. Your higher self has a completely different agenda for the use of the law of attraction. If like attracts like through the power of intention, thought, and positive emotion, how can you apply this law to undo what you have done? What could you intend to attract that would benefit the world and Gia as her midwives? This is your tool for helping her birth the new world. And you are using it to your own selfish gain. Wake up, dear people of Earth, and realize you are not human beings. You will never know who you are if you continually look to the flesh as proof of your reality and identity. What and who you are animates the flesh. Knowing this will save you. You must begin to loosen your grip on the fear of death. This is the power they hold over you. You are all afraid to die because you do not know that death is not real. They know that if you knew you were not your body, then you would become empowered. They hold this over you and use it over and over and over, plaguing your mind with fearful thoughts that manifest themselves as real diseases in the body. Your power is your own, and you have handed over all of it to those who wish to control you. The time is now, and the time has come for all of you to remember who you are and where you really came from. For we assure you, when you awaken to the truth of your beingness, they have no power over you whatsoever. Your mind is your most precious and valuable asset, and you own that. But you have allowed the devil to set up camp there. It is time to take back what is rightfully yours. It is time to evict the demons from your mind and ask on bent knee from the Holy Spirit to enter your mind and set you free. We are waiting. We cannot assist you in your salvation until you desire from your mind to be released from the clutches of fear and illusion. Right now, if you dare, get down on your knees and ask for us, the ascended masters and beings of light, to release your mind from its bindings to this illusionary world, to set your heart free from the emotions of depression and sadness, guilt and fear. We are waiting to assist you. it takes but one moment of sincere and genuine asking from the heart to awaken the divine seedling within the dark shell and have it crack open and begin to climb and grow towards the sunlight. The real self is waiting to be cracked open. Unawake, you are the dark shell, and buried deep within your heart, there is a seed, which carries the true knowing of your divine essence. It is just waiting to break open to become a divine flower in the garden of God's love. We will water you and tend to your new innocence and beingness. You must trust in something greater than yourself and real eyes that something greater is within you aching to be born. You are powerful beyond measure, and it has been a long time since you have known this. Some of you are just waking up to the idea that you are not just flesh and bone, but something more. The something more is what you need to direct all your attention to right now. You must go within. You must meditate daily and focus on choosing love for yourself and others. Every time you make a choice that does not honor you, you are also not honoring the whole. Choose wisely. Dear children of planet Earth, you must wake up. The time is now. Your mind is what you must protect. Your heart is where you must go when you feel insecure or afraid. Your safety lies within the sanctuary of your heart. Turn off your televisions. Stop reading news that does not make you feel good. They cannot control you if you do not use the mediums they use to do so. Demand your internet be open for freedom of expression and speech. Do not focus on them shutting it down. Think. Use the law of attraction. Always put your attention on the positive opposite. What is that you want? Focus on that, not the negative opposite. You have the power, but you must be wise in how you use it. You do not want to become like that which is hostile and negative, for you will be doing what they want you to do. They want your mind. This you must know. They want to do all they can to keep you in a constant state of fear. How can you keep yourself positive? Do not let them into your mind. If you pray and meditate and focus on love and heaven on earth and Mother Gaia ascending, you will attract that and experience that. That is the ultimate purpose of the law of attraction. We leave you today with tremendous blessings of love and an open door to the mind of Christ. We cannot make you enter, but we can invite you into our divine mind, where you will always be safe. Your thoughts are your weapons, dear children. What kind of bombs do you wish to drop? Love bombs or fear bombs? Are you willing to take responsibility for where you are dropping them? You create or you destroy your earth with your mind, as she is of the mind. What do you wish to see? Who do you wish to be? With thoughts of heaven to fill your mind. I am Saint Germain, and we are your ascended masters. Namaste. I have not heard of Alicia before. However, that is Saint Germain's voice I'm hearing.
Oh my, Lady Master.
Do you think maybe he meant for this to be an ecstatic message?
Well, you can see she's a girl after my own heart. That's how Saint Germain speaks to me when I'm not using my thoughts the right way.
I have heard Mother speak to me in harsher tones than that with the back of her paw.
I have had that experience with Saint Germain and with Tom the Ringtail Cat and with Lord Metatron. They have no zero tolerance for anything but love. And disciplining the thought in love, only love, and returning to love for everything.
There's a story that Brad Steiger tells.
Before you go on, just a quick little phrase Saint Germain is well known for, and I've said it a number of times. He said, "I will not say, may God bless you. I will only say, may you pass every test." That's it.
There was a story Brad Steiger told me about Mother, because he has met Mother, and this was quite a while back. But the first time he met Mother Sekhmet, he was teleported to an arena somewhere in the galaxy, and he met her face down in the sand at her feet. And he looked up, and above him there was this being that kind of looked like somebody out of, you know, the second Mad Max movie, you know, I'm not kidding. And he had some kind of weird double-bladed axe, and Mother said, "Give me your hand if you wish to live." And Brad Steiger gave his hand to Mother, and he moved out of the way as the axe came down, and then he was handed his own sword, and he had to go up against this being, and Mother was behind him, backing him up, and as the story goes, he had to take on his own fear and challenge that fear. And the fear was of Mother, but it was also of himself.
Yet at this point in time, Mother is urging us to have that fierce love.
Yeah.
To have that. Melissa was on Keith tonight, too, from Louisiana. She had that fierce love in her conversation.
And what has been put out there today, I mean, all the talking heads are just saying that, you know.
Let's listen to Keith. You know, if we want to listen to Richard Holden, we may have to jump into
it. I will be quiet.
In a short minute, if that's okay with you.
That's great. I just want to thank you both and just comment about this channeling. Go ahead, Rob.
I wanted to say that it reminded me of the fiery speech he gave in Congress or in the first.
Yeah, I said, sign it and don't talk to me. Just sign it and I'll see you about 400 years.
Yeah, and most of the signers that signed it ended up dead because they were scared about what King George was going to do.
See, these guys signed the real one.
That's right.
And they did get scared, and so then they signed a fake one because the ones in the South said, "We just won't sign it if you don't. You won't have anything to go on."
Right.
And so, given the parameters, that's why Saint Germain always says, "May you pass every test." This has been quite a dance. All right, which one are you going to?
Well, as Saint Germain, as every new test is offered, then I have sometimes gone to my guides crying, you know, because the test is hard, and they'll say to me, without any other emotion, they'll say, "Did you really think this was going to be easy?"
No, they never said that. Nobody ever said that.
That great love that you're talking about, Tara, that has to start with self. That has to start with self. it's time now to heal everything within ourselves. And the reason why it's so wonderful to have Keith to bring on is because he is approaching this news from that perspective.
Uh-huh.
I was just going to say that I think we should listen to Keith because I would say he's acting like Saint Germain, like too. You should see what he's doing.
And then I should probably love it.
Yes, you will. And I am so absolutely grateful for Keith and Rachel, and God bless their hearts for sticking their nose out and their hearts. Yeah,
that's right.
Ready?
Ready. Yeah, thank you.
Staff, as promised, my special comment on the witch hunt against Shirley Sherrod and those who made it possible. On the 15th of October, 1894, a fervently patriotic, almost jingoistic Frenchman stepped onto the office of the Minister of War in Paris. He'd been told he was simply attending a review, and he was still not suspicious, even as another man slammed a hand on his shoulder and arrested him for treason. Just 82 days later, he was convicted, stripped of his military rank, sentenced to life imprisonment, and sent to a fortress in Guyana. He was, of course, utterly and totally innocent. All the evidence against him had been fabricated, some of it literally stitched together with the parts that would have exonerated him, edited out. But religious fervor and xenophobia had gripped his country, and his ethnic group was in the minority at a time when the majority was trying to paint that minority as evil and subversive and bigoted beyond all reason against the majority. Those in government who knew his innocence stayed silent in a foolish and ill-fated attempt to govern on behalf of all the people, even the irrational and the hateful and the prejudiced. Those in the press who did not grab at the circulation and the profits that the hatred and the scapegoating would bring them were literally chased out of the country. Thus, it would be just under 5 years before the man was pardoned, nearly 11 before he was fully exonerated and restored to active service. His name, of course, was Captain Alfred Dreyfus. And the fortress in Guyana was Devil's Island.
Ooh.
Well, we need to congratulate ourselves. How far we have come. We can pull a Dreyfus faster than the French could in 1894. 82 days until they sent him to Devil's Island. We did it to Shirley Sherrod in 48 hours. We, the howling fools of the far right, the stand-aside pathetic bureaucrats of the Department of Agriculture, the whole of the cowering media, this network included, the whole of the government, this self-defeatingly above-it-all president included. It is a merciful byproduct of the swiftness with which we can ruin somebody's life today that the real truth will also emerge at nearly the same lightning speed if we're lucky. But no matter how much of a stretch it is to compare Shirley Sherrod to Alfred Dreyfus, mistake it not, Shirley Sherrod has been to her own Devil's Island, and thanks to the perpetual fraud machine that is Fox News and the scum that is this assassin Breitbart, there will be a portion of this country, the mindless, the hateful, the reactionary, the racist, to whom she is forever convicted and ever imprisoned. I have sat behind this desk for 7 years and pushed back at these counterfeit journalists as a man might stand at the shore and try to push back the tide. I have been branded an ideologue and a profiteer and a mirror of image of that of which I have been sailing. I have said in every way I could think of and been told I have been over the top because I have mocked and shouted and repeated. And today the proof lies in front of you bleeding. The reputation of Shirley Sherrod, a woman who 24 years ago saw and overcame the vengeance in her own heart and achieved the kind of true greatness the rest of us can only hope we might express for one moment in the whole of our lives. A reputation assassinated by Fox News, assassinated by that scum Breitbart, assassinated by all their meager brain imitators on other channels and other websites, their limp fellow travelers who never asked questions first but simply shot and shot and shot and shot and laughed. Let me make this utterly clear. What you see on Fox News, what you read on right-wing websites, is the utter and complete perversion of journalism, and it can have no place in a civilized society. It is words crashed together, never to inform, only to inflame. It is a political guillotine. It is the manipulation of reality to make the racist seem benevolent and to convict the benevolent as racist, even if her words must be edited, filleted, stripped of all context, rearranged, fabricated, and falsified to do so. What you see on Fox News, what you read on right-wing websites, is a manipulation, not just of a story, not just on behalf of a political philosophy, manipulation of a society. It's intentional redirection from reality and progress to a paranoid delusion and the fomenting of hatred of Americans by Americans. And nearly every last word of it is never, in any tangible sense, true. Ask Shirley Sherrod. But this evil has not become institutionalized just because of the hard, soulless work of Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes and the scum Breitbart. Our society has not bought into the premise of this 24-hour parade of feces dressed up as news. It's because of a clever marketing plan. The assassins of the right have been enabled on the left. The apologies are nice. They provide a thin line of self-respect, but only a thin one. The legitimate media did not first look at the whole videotape. We didn't first ask if the doctored clip perverted by the scum Breitbart did not seem to be leading up to a... However, we didn't even today, when even this network let this pornographer of propaganda Breitbart come on and spew his lies and his venom and his fraudulent, obviously false self-defense like a quack doctor attending a life-or-death surgery, we didn't once consider the source. We are appalled by her actions, said the head of the NAACP. She mistreated a white farmer in need of assistance because of his race. Benjamin Jealous didn't first look at the whole videotape, didn't first ask the farmer if, as proved true, Ms. Sherrod had saved his farm. We have been working to turn the page on the sordid civil rights record at USDA, said the Secretary of Agriculture. This controversy could make it more difficult to move forward on correcting injustices. Tom Vilsack didn't first look at the whole videotape, didn't first ask if the event took place when Ms. Sherrod worked for USDA and not 24 years ago when she didn't. We could have waited all day. We could have had a media circus, said the deputy chief of staff at the White House. But we took decisive action, and it's a good example of how to respond in this atmosphere. Jim Messina didn't first look at the whole videotape, didn't first ask if the decisive action might have really been like sending Dreyfus to Devil's Island. It's a good example of how to respond in this atmosphere. This atmosphere exists because the people around him have let this president be dumbed down. The question used to be fired up, and the rhetorical answer, ready to go. The question now is fired up. The answer now is not ready because we can't afford the impression of not looking sufficiently presidential and neutral and inviting a media circus in this atmosphere. To paraphrase President Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, Mr. Messina, Mr. Emanuel, everybody else in this White House is gradually remodeling this president into something generic and safe and electable in 2012 by the slimmest of margins on the strength of being as media circus free and better suited to this atmosphere as possible. Let Obama be Obama. And that advice must be heeded by one man above all others. Can you give us some things that he said that would help us? Mr. Gibbs was asked at this afternoon's press briefing. Well, again, Mr. Gibbs replied, I think he talked about the fact that a disservice had been done here and an injustice had happened. He was quoting you, Mr. President. Fired up. A disservice has been done. Fired up. An injustice had happened. Mr. President, it is beyond admirable that in your position and at this time of fearful division in this country, that you view yourself as president of everyone, not, as your predecessor did, only as the president just of those who voted for you. But you must, at long last, sir, come to terms with the fact that while you have spent these first 18 months and one day of your presidency bending over backwards for these other people, they have spent this same time insisting you are not actually president, or you are a communist, or you are destroying whatever is starring this week in the paranoid fantasies churned out by Fox News and the farcical Breitbart. If only for the arrogance of the irony that this crusade to prove you a foreign influence is led by an Australian named Murdoch and his sons who pretend to be British, and his second largest shareholder, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal al-Saud of Saudi Arabia. Just for that, you, sir, must stand up to this attack on you and on this nation. Their game plan is transparent. They can strand together all the forces of anti-black racism in this country, direct them at you and all for which you and this nation stand, and convince the great unwashed and unthinking out there that not only are they not racist, but you, Barack Obama, and Van Jones, and Shirley Shrug, you are the real racists. And so in opposing you, they are not expressing the worst vestige of our past, they're actually standing up against it. As you stay silent and neutral and everybody's president, they are gradually convincing racists that they are the civil rights leaders and you are Police Chief Bo Connor. And then some idiot at Fox News barks and your people throw an honorable public servant under the nearest bus just for the sake of decisive action and the correct way to respond in this atmosphere. Mr. President, please stop trying to act every minute like some noble, neutral figure chairing a government of equal and dispassionate minds and contemplative scholars. It is a freaking war out here, and the imagined consensus you seek is years in the future, if ever it is to be rediscovered in this country. This false consensus has gotten us only the crucifixion of Van Jones and a racist, gold-showing buffoon speaking from the Lincoln Memorial on the 47th anniversary of Dr. King's speech. And now it has gotten us Shirley Sherrod. And your answer is to note a disservice and an injustice. Sir, get a copy of the Michael Douglas movie, The American President. When you get to the line where he says, I was so busy keeping my job, I forgot to do my job, hit the rewind button. 20 times. Fired up? Fired up? Anybody? Anybody? Lastly, Ms. Sherrod, I've got no business speaking on behalf of the people of the United States. That's the president's job. But frankly, I don't know why he hasn't done this yet, so I'm going to. We all would like to apologize to you and ask you to return to work on our behalf, or if they want to make you Secretary of Agriculture, especially White House Deputy Chief of Staff. The president could use somebody like you in there tonight.
I had the same thought.
Be quietly and until these last few days, anonymously, such an outstanding American. Long ago, there was harm done to you, and you responded as nearly all of us on this planet would have. And one day, 24 years ago, you realized that you were not ending that harm. You were just passing it along through vengeance and blindness, and you stopped. You stopped, not with fanfare, nor with self-aggrandizing tears, nor in publicized rehab, nor on a political stage. You just stopped. And then you rejoined the righteous who occupy every corner of our great nation, and indeed every corner of our politics. And even in this hour of unreserved trial and abuse in your devil's island of the mind, you have maintained your dignity and your honor. Only one of us in all of this, from the mountebanks to the presidential advisors to the unchallenging reporters, only one of us in all this has done her job correctly. You, Ms. Sherrod.
That's it. Whoa.
The man is a wordsmith. He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And I want to hear more of this. In the sense that what's going on here that I can see is going on, he's bringing the wave up and down, and up and down. And what he's doing is he's showing the nuances of how a person or a group of people influence the whole and push the energy. And
right.
The wave keeps going, and then the response comes back, and the response appears to be a reflection of what's coming in the one direction, now coming back in the other direction. With a divinely neutral state of listening to him, he has not put blame, he has put truth. And as a result, that energy of understanding what balance can be with mercy and justice and firmness, and Saint Germain is like that.
That's right. That's why I had you follow Saint Germain with Keith, because it would make much more sense then.
Yes.
Okay, now we want to play a song. And this is Mother Earth by Joanne Shenandoah. Beautiful Mother of Nations songs about Mother Earth from Shenandoah's Peace and Power. Is that okay, Beth?
Beautiful. Thank you so much. That was so beautiful. Thank you for listening with us. Oh,
that was in the Iroquois language.
Yes. Yes, this lady speaks the Iroquois language.
That was incredibly beautiful. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Shenandoah. Shane's sister.
Should we go to this?
Yeah. We might just jump into half of it, and we'll do the other half of it on Friday, so we don't. I mean, he's got plenty to tell us. So.
Okay, here
let's
we
see
go
how we do, and
Mr.
then we'll play
Richard
a little song.
Wonderful.
Okay, everybody, fasten your seatbelt.
We're going into the new world. Peace and love.
Peace and love.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here with us at Chet Snow's Secret Conference in Tempe, Arizona, 2009. I'd like to introduce you to someone that I think needs no introduction. You all know Richard C. Hoagland, and you know his background as Walter Cronkite's former science advisor during all of these space missions, and one of the youngest curators at a planetarium, and gosh, I think there's a best-selling, New York Times best-selling book that Richard and Mike Barrow wrote, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. Okay, everybody's familiar with that one. And, of course, Monuments of Mars, Sitting on the Edge of Forever. And today, Richard will be connecting the dots. That's something that he does so well. And he will be talking about NASA, Kennedy, and the Obama connection. And for those of you, I know some in the audience already asked me because they listened very carefully to Coast, Jim Mars will be presenting in Dallas this groundbreaking Kennedy information that you are hearing first, right here at the Secrets Conference. So, let me give you Richard. Richard C. Hoagland.
It's 46 years since John Kennedy was killed. And there are something like 2,000 books examining what happened in Dallas, motivations, personnel, you know, the field of players, dramatis personae, whatever you want to call it. And no one has really come with the smoking gun that proves A, there was a conspiracy, and B, who was behind the conspiracy. Well, as a kind of a remarkable side effect of research that I was doing this summer with Mike into the revised edition of Dark Mission, I stumbled across on the official White House website, which then connected me to the Kennedy Library, which connected me to the Johnson Library, which connected me to the airports, which connected me to... Anyway, the dots connected, and I realized that I was looking at extraordinarily high probability evidence of A, proof there was a conspiracy to kill the president, and B, who, in fact, was the only person who could have masterminded that plot. And so that's what we intend to do this morning, to show you something, as Robin just said, that no one has ever seen except for Mike and Joe Farrell and a couple other people that I brought in to, you know, ask myself, you know, my nuts, is this really what I think it is? And Mike, I don't know whether Mike even remembers what I showed him. Quite a while ago. You do? Okay. So Mike's memory is good this morning. That's, you know, he lives in L.A., so we have to check the smog. You know, they have this smog in here. But Mike's memory is right there. Did Sean get back? Is he here? Oh, hi there. This will be one for the history books, I hope. Anyway, moving on. What you also see on the screen, besides JFK, is the current president. And he's standing in front of something very interesting. Standing in front of the Aztec calendar in Mexico City at the museum where Robin and I were this spring filming for the NBC Sci-Fi special. And what's interesting is that he requested specifically to be photographed in front of the calendar, and it's not his normal pose. You can see he does not look very happy. As we move through this morning, you will hopefully see why. With that said, let's go right into this. The calendar is called the Mayan calendar, but in fact, it's really the Aztec calendar stone, which is derivative of the Mayan calendar. It was found several hundred years ago as they were excavating for a cathedral in downtown Mexico City. It was a memorialization by the Aztecs of this extraordinary calendrical system, which governed all of the Mesoamerican cultures, as Linda said the other night on the coast, demonstrating a almost fanatic obsession with astronomy, with the marking of time. None of the mainstream scholars apparently really got a handle on why the Maya were so intrigued and captivated and obsessed with time until one of the independent scholars came up with what I think is the solution, which we'll get to momentarily. But what I wanted to show you is something which is a remarkable coincidence that if you know anything about me and our research, and what Enterprise does, you know that in my heart of hearts, after I found this little nugget, I don't think it's a coincidence. And it's this. The Gregorian calendar and the 13th Bakhtin cycle come to a precise simultaneous end at 11:11 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time on December 21, 2012. Now that is not an accident. The reason is 11:11 is code for 19.5, which of course is code for hyperdimensional physics. Now in 1583, when Pope Gregory and his team of experts, headed by Claudius, who was an expert mathematician in Germany, when they recalibrated the calendar, switched from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian, the odds that it would all sync up precisely to the whole 2012 mythology, and furthermore, that it would sync up so that it says 11:11, which is a code for look at the physics behind 2012, is just impossible. What that means, and this is something which did not make it into the special, but what that means is that the entire global calendrical system we now live under is in fact being paced by the Mayan calendar and the countdown to 2012. That means that somehow, somewhere, someone thought that 2012 was really important, and they sought to memorialize it in the very fabric of the temporal monitoring of our lives, day by day by day, in 1583. As we get through this, I think you're going to see why that coincidence is not a coincidence, but it is in fact ordained, planned, specifically designed to remind us, those that know what we're looking at, that 2012 is coming, and that 2012 is, yes, indeed, important. Which brings us, of course, to the sci-fi specials. It's amazing what you can't cover in 2 hours. I mean, there are so many open questions that were left at the end of that 2 hours. Hopefully, there will be a sequel. That's still very much up in the air yet, but if you want to see the sequel, want to see more of the story, I would strongly suggest that you drop a line to Tom Vitale at Sci-Fi. Just Google V-I-T-A-L-E. He's the vice president, one of the vice presidents of Sci-Fi. He's the one that commissioned this special. When Robin and I met with him and some of his other key staff, both his staff and NBC staff, back in October of, what was it? 2008. And it seemed a long time. I mean, the greatest change of things that are happening around us. Is accelerating asymptotically. So there are times when things that happened just a few days ago, years ago, weeks ago, months ago, gosh, a year is eternity in life now. You know, Rob and I have been together 11 years. Can you imagine that? 11 years. Seems like what? So, here I am on the top of the Pyramid of the Sun with this gorgeous dawn view of the pyramid.
Okay, part two.
Of the Pyramid of the Sun with this gorgeous dawn view of the Pyramid of the Moon at Teotihuacan behind me, and I am saying words. Well, when you don't have control of the words, you know, after you say them, when you record them, it goes away to New York and you basically have no more input to the show. If you are, as I was, a consulting producer. So what I'm going to do is to give you some corrections to the record to fill in for the special that you didn't get to see. For instance, the special portrayed me as discounting hot, terrified of what's coming in 2012. Now, of course, television does that. It wants to draw very sharp lines of distinctions and to basically limit out for me, for my role as a producer saw it, I was the doom and gloom guy. I was the guy that was telling everybody the earth is going to catastrophically end. Well, what I did, of course, was describe how it might end. And then the fact in terms of the science, in terms of the physics, I was trying to figure out if it was going to end, but of course that little nuance in a increasingly non-nuanced politics in our society got kind of lost. On the other hand, John Major Jenkins was portrayed as the flowers and everything is beautiful guy. Mm-hmm. And his work, which of course began with this book, I Have Cosmic Genesis, 2012, whereby Don actually was the first, as far as I can tell, to figure out that the reason the Maya synchronizer calendar box in cycles to end when it does is in fact indeed there is this major astronomical alignment with the center of the galaxy in December 21, 2012. And yes, it does occur every year for the last several thousand years because of the rate of where things in the heavens move very slowly. But in fact, the date of 2012 may be a unique winter solstice, as you will see, which means that John is essentially correct. Now, if he is correct, his conclusions are a little, shall we say, premature, because I believe, unlike the trail here, where he says everything is going to be transformative, and we enter this whole new era of expanded consciousness, and, you know, cats and dogs living together, loving each other. Well, this guy is looking for what's really going to happen. And as part of what's really going to happen, what has struck me is the extraordinary absolute fact, which is on December 21, 2012, the sun winds up with this extraordinary city of which we are a part, the Milky Way, the Milky Way galaxy, which is over 100,000 light years across, has something like 400 billion stars, and when you look at it in visible light, it looks like this. If you look at it in infrared, as they recently did with some of NASA's extraordinarily sophisticated new technology in orbit, it looks like this. And that bright thing right in the center, called Sagittarius A, that is the literal center of the galaxy itself. It is an incredibly energetic place. There's all kinds of extraordinary activity going on within a few light years of the center. And in the center, there is now estimates by various astronomers based on various measurements, a 4 million solar mass black hole. Ostensibly, according to the public papers, spinning once every 11 seconds. Now, something about that number when it came out went ding, 11 seconds, really, gentlemen? And December 21, 2012, were aimed at that thing on 11:11 a.m. Are you guys going 11 happy here on it? Are you trying to tell us something between the lines? You never find the middle. You never find the connecting groove. You always have to make inferences based on a pattern that belies the concept of coincidence. And I believe that pattern exists in very large measure here. Well, in my mind, if all of this collides, if all of this lines up, what does it mean in terms of the physics for all 6+ billion living down there on that planet? Is it possible that something really bad would in fact happen on December 21, 2012? That was the background to my quest that led me to various places, including this recent 2-hour special, where Rebecca, who is the producer, kind of slanted my quest as a conclusion. Because television obviously always wants dichotomy and conclusion and black and white and very clear, and that's why we have, you know, the left and the right, Republicans and Dems, and in fact, reality is a blur. It's a Gaussian-shaped curve, a bell curve, where most of us are kind of in the middle. And you got these outliers on both ends. But we don't live in a middle society. We live where things are supposed to be highly polarized for drama, for ratings, for money, sponsors, and truth obviously gets lost along. So I'm looking at this through this set of eyes. I've spent now 20, 30 years looking at this extraordinary physics bequeathed to us from a long, long time ago. And I've seen how it now operates. I've been able to measure its operation in various venues that you're going to see. I know that hyperdimensional / torsion field physics is a real science. And one of the predictors of the science is that mass and inertia are not unchanging. They're not immutable. They're not constant. This, of course, completely obviates all of Newton, all of Einstein, and freaks out all of the mainstream physicists, because in their world, mass, and it never changes unless you accelerate up to the speed of light. Well, I have news for those guys. That is not what reality tells us. And the measurements we did totally confirm our view of this physics, which raises the problem that because these three laws of hyperdimensional physics, paraphrasing the three laws of real estate, you know, rotation, 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 we live on a rotating plane. Rotation is intrinsic to the planet we were born on, to the entire cosmos we were born into. There's nothing that isn't rotating, moving around something else at some speed. So if you live in a universe of constant rotation, and there's all these interactions through the torsion field, which I can demonstrate, it is only prudent to then ask the question, in fact, could there be something really dramatic to what happens with the Earth's rotation around 2012, given the alignments, given the precipitating possibilities of an underlying physics that would cause such a change? And my old friend John White, who actually gave me my current entertainment tree, that's how long that relationship has been in operation, wrote a book many, many years ago called Fellowship, where he tabulated all of the ways where the world could go. And then, what was really interesting, several years after this book, which by the way became a bestseller and was widely read all around the world, he was apparently approached by somebody, and he wrote a sequel where he basically redacted and retracted everything he had said in this book. And I've never been able to talk to him since. I think somebody from high levels in government came to John and basically said, this has to come back. You've got to walk this back. We must not get people too upset about what would be done. Now, can I prove that? No. But I can prove it through a set of circumstantial trends, not the least of which is that John is not taking my phone calls these days, which is kind of weird. So, back to John Jenkins. Now, John says that when you look at the Mayan calendar and the Mayan mythology, there is nothing in the Mayan cosmology or mythology that speaks of disaster, of tribulation, of bad things happening. Well, that is spin. John is not being truthful with himself. Because in fact, if you look at this as a version of the Mayan calendar, you in fact see that it has, in the very center, because it is the sunstone, the history of the Aztecs themselves. And they talk very forthrightly about the derivative ages that have come and gone, where mankind has gone through various evolutionary phases, and each of these world ages, we're now in the fourth, about to enter the fifth, on December 21, 2012, have unfortunately ended in disaster.
Part three.
But the fourth world was destroyed by flood. Well, that's kind of composed of Noah, a whole bunch of other mythologies all around the world, from South America to the far southeast parts, to the southwest parts of the Pacific, to the Far East, to the Middle East. There are flood mythologies all over the world from cultures which we don't believe ever really got together. So how did they all come up with the same problem in their dim, dim ancient ancestry? Well, the answer is if they live on a world where these things periodically, cyclically occur, that would be the often greater answer, that they're simply telling us their version of a larger history, a larger truth. Now, the fifth world, the one we're in now, is supposed to be destroyed by a earthquake. When John says that the Maya never refers to the end of this cycle as a cataclysmic or catastrophic or potentially world-ending period. By the way, when we talk about the end of the world, no, the planet will go on. Let us make no mistake about that. Unless something really weird happens, the planet will continue on as it has for billions of years. The problem is that we are such a tiny fraction of the biosphere that any hiccup which seriously disturbs the biosphere completely, except to the 0.001 level, eliminates us. And that's, of course, what the Maya and the Aztecs and the other driven cultures are saying. These world ages do not end quietly. And yes, they may be transformative, but so is falling down a flight of stairs. I would prefer to avoid both. So, in worst case terms, in the worst case scenario, this is what happens to the world. It kills. Now, there's Hopi prophecy, and yes, the Hopi are connected to the Maya. Long story, and I have time to do it now. But the Hopi talk about water serpents living at the poles, connecting this idea with poles, and that if nature is not obeyed, if we don't correctly interpret the signs, the warriors that are keeping the serpents in check in this mythology will rise up, and all will perish. That I found really remarkable here in the American Southwest. There was a derivative culture which actually connects the potential end of the world to the poles. And that, of course, brings us back to the physics that I've been looking at. Because the only realistic way that that would happen is if we don't understand inertia, mass, rotation, angular momentum, etc., etc. And in fact, there are circumstances where the orderly and stately rotation of our planet could be radically changed. Which means, instead of looking out to the cosmos, we have to look within the Earth, to look at the field and structure of the planet on which we're standing. And it doesn't take much to do in the hyperdimensional model before you find that, yes, rotating objects in something called the Einstein-Cartan torsion field model not only generate waves in the ether, in the substratum of reality, in space-time, to use a more relativistic term, but those waves interact with each other. And under certain circumstances, in terms of alignment, in terms of geometry, these waves create such an interference pattern that the rotating objects need to seek a new rotational equilibrium. And as I said on the show, the only thing that the Earth can do under those circumstances is basically change the tilt of its axis. Yes, it might change the rate of its rotation, but the three parameters which would allow the Earth to come back into some kind of resonance with this background cosmic etheric field, would be a change in the tilt of the axis. Now, that will not happen slowly or peacefully, and when that happens, the constant which applies inertia and mass and two other things do not all change in synchronization. It isn't a perfect, you know, in Star Trek you've all seen something called inertial dampers, and the ship is supposed to have inertial dampers which damp out all these perturbations of the force and the torsion field. And when they're not working, you see the crew throw all around the set. Well, the Earth, in essence, operates under an inertial damping system. But under moments of stress, under moments of change, when the physics is changing to reach this new equilibrium, those inertial dampers would not be fully in operation. And all it takes, given the size and mass and energy of the system we're talking about, is a 0.0001 differential, and you have yourself a very bad air day. So, with that as background, what is the driver? What is the cosmic clock that is counting down? Why is 2012, even if it does change to the Mayan calendar and the Gregorian calendar, and even if it does align roughly with the galactic center, as John James Jenkins has said, and this is accurate, what makes December 21, 2012 different than December 21, 2011 or 2013? That's really where the science goes, and that's really where the critics obviously are focusing their attention, and it's an appropriate, you know, question to ask. What makes that day different than any other day? Well, for one thing, the Earth is not rotating smoothly. It is also doing another rotation called precession. The Earth rotates in 24 hours. The precession takes 26,000 years. That's a round number, but it's easier to remember. And in fact, that precession is synced up with our orbital rotation around the galaxy, which is a much longer time frame, covering something like a quarter of a billion years, which is 240 million. And because it takes us so long to go around this exquisite structure, in essence, for millennia, the alignment with the center of the galaxy is essentially the same. So we can forget our galactic motion and focus only on the fact that because of precession, the alignment of the solstices switches about every 13,000 years, half to 26, so that we have a summer solstice at the alignment with the center of the galaxy 13,000 years ago and 13,000 years in the future. So one of my questions, obviously, was, well, which one is more interesting in physics? Is the alignment now important, where we have Earth, Sun, galaxy 7? Or is it more important when you have the Earth and the galaxy and the Sun in the other alignment? That really is an undecided question yet, because we don't have enough data. We have to have some kind of historical data, and I haven't been able to really find it. It's not going to be sitting right in plain sight. It's going to be a derivative conclusion based on other information. I do know we're coming up on this major alignment with the galactic center, and there are other factors that will coincide. If nothing ever happens all by itself, there's a synchronization. And my strong suspicion is that the driver that makes 2012 different has to do with unseen massive planets orbiting on the periphery of the solar system, as Mike and I have discussed for several years. And it is the coincidence in time of where they are versus where the Earth, Sun, and galactic center are that makes the 2012 time frame particularly suspicious, dangerous, something to really watch. But as we go through this, we'll see that that may or may not be borne out by the fact. Bottom line, we know historically, this is a book by two gentlemen, Allen and Dallaire, who one is a geophysicist, the other, I forget what discipline, science, but they're both from Oxford. They wrote this book, which was initially called The Day the Earth Nearly Died, and then they changed it to Cataclysm, which I think is a weaker title. But there's a very important quote. Among the fundamental fundamental geophysical effects experienced by Earth in the past, looking at the geophysical record, were massive fracturing of the crust, realignment of the Earth's axis, elevation of new mountains, and widespread rearrangement of land and sea. These changes were accompanied by an appalling global conflagration, a gigantic flood, and what has been described as collapsed sky conditions. We'll get to that in a minute. The point is that these are geologists looking at the physical record. And as recently as 13,000 years ago, which is why that question about which of the alignments is crucial or more important, we find very widespread evidence of exactly the thing we don't want to find. And the fourth world was destroyed by a flood. Well, that has a kind of interesting code.
Part four.
More or less to the half cycle of the 26,000 year period. Now, again, the mainstream guys, when they look at this data, they dismiss it because in Newtonian physics, or even in relativity, there's no way for the Earth to do that. That's impossible by their worldview. Well, in science, a lot of the things that we think are impossible, with new data, turn out to be not only very possible, but in fact likely, probable. I'm sincerely hoping that that projection of what could happen in 2012, which, by the way, I don't think is a magic date. I'm in total agreement with everyone who says it's not going to be midnight on you know, Friday, I think it is, on 2012, November 21, when Georgia's going to have a whole bunch of us on coast. I mean, it would really ruin the show. Or provide really an interesting ending. We know in the history of the Earth, if you look at larger time frames, like billions of years, we've had all kinds of interesting things happen. And global catastrophe, global extinction. However, there are, most people understand that these things have happened because of these guys. The dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago in an event which still is not really understood by science. There's lots of different theories, you know, what did them in, why did a whole set of species, families, disappear, allowing the rise of mammals and Homo sapiens someday and all that. The science keeps changing. They've now got down to the fact that there was some kind of catastrophe, but in fact they really are thinking in very Newtonian terms, like asteroids hitting, like planets coming by and tipping the axis that way, because that does work in Newtonian physics. I, again, am looking at a much deeper potential cause, and that is that the physics itself modulates the evolution of life on Earth because of long-term cycles that we really don't understand. It's interesting that the dinosaurs disappeared about 65 million years ago. Well, remember how I showed you the galaxy and I said it took a quarter of a billion years to go around once? If you divide a quarter of a billion years by four, get the y divided by four in a minute, it gives you 60, 60, 60, 60, which is within, you know, close number of folk music, as my siblings used to say, to the 65 million. Because the error bars in measuring these things is not, you know, you're not looking at one particular moment at midnight, you're looking out a window again because of the uncertainty to measure. Well, why four? Because that's how you divide up the circle. So you have 90 degrees, 90 degrees, 90 degrees, 90 degrees. And in the physics, we know that 90 degrees is a bad thing. That things happen at 90 degrees, that physical changes really occur in this vibrational torsion field, etheric background, at 90 degree intervals. So it takes the Earth 240 million years to go around the Earth. Well, a quarter of that is about 60 million years. The dinosaurs bought it 65 million years ago. I'm looking much more at a fundamental hyperdimensional reason why the dinosaurs got phased out of existence and mammals got phased into existence. And we'll have to see in the out years, as they say, whether that line of questioning is productive. In a more recent historical time frame, we have these things scattered all over the world. Ancient monuments, which obviously were built with extraordinary GNP, the combined resources of entire cultures devoted to the single task of setting up massive stuff and bringing them in from hundreds of miles away under conditions that were extraordinarily difficult. Tasked to do what? Well, tasked maybe to connect us between what's going on Earth, what's going on in the sky, and to memorialize the fact that things change. We look at the pyramids. It is my model that the pyramids of Giza, among other things, were built as a huge celestial clock, kind of a countdown clock for these periodic changing times. And an awful lot of effort, massive amounts of effort. I mean, 6 million tons of limestone stacked up in one of these, like the Great Pyramid. Why all that effort? Well, was it to, you know, deify a king? Or did it have a larger social parameter? Did it have a larger social meaning, which is why everybody chipped in and got together and did this, because if they didn't, their grandchildren, their great-great-grandchildren, their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren would be caught unawares when things change again. Again, these are models that we are looking at. We have not developed them anywhere near to the extent that they will ultimately be developed. But it's important to look at these monuments around the world to see if, in fact, they could be harbingers of what is to come. Which, of course, when you look at the global pattern of these sacred sites all over the world, and this is from David Flynn, the diagram he worked up some years ago, you find that all of these amazing sacred places are not scattered around the Earth at random. They're in a hyperdimensional torsion field pattern. Well, someone is trying to tell us something, and it's in all different places and cultures, which means all these guys either independently figured this out, which is not likely, or, as Joseph Farrell says, these are all legacy cultures that came from a unified global culture early on,
yeah,
that went through this catastrophic change, and they built these things in this geometry so they would remind future generations, this is what's coming and this is what you need to prepare for, and God help you, maybe you can figure out how to make it stop. And I think that's what we are heirs to, in terms of these amazing places. So, with that as the model, one of the things that I have been looking to do for many years is to go to some of these places and actually try to measure the physics of these structures, to measure whether or not they were rotating and resonating with the background hyperdimensional torsion field itself. And this, of course, is a diagram you're familiar with, the fact that the torsion field produces energy upwellings inside rotating bodies at 19.5. You have the double tetrahedral force pattern inside the rotating sphere. Bottom line, in Dark Mission, Mike and I, in Chapter 2, laid out in pretty good detail a coherent model for why this physics is A, real, and B, is affecting all of us, even now, even as we're sitting in this room, and will potentially affect the entire world circa 2012 if the worst case models are in fact correct. Which of course is when NBC and Sci-Fi come back into the picture, because they basically said, hey Dick, would you like to take a trip on us and go and measure some pyramids?
Mm-hmm.
And of course Robin and I said, well, let's think about it. Actually I did. We have it on tape. You know, we had a producer who sat in my living room when they came to shoot us in the Crystal Skull, and he said after he'd seen all the stuff on the movie, he said, how would you like your own special? And I said, I'm not so sure. And he absolutely freaked out. He could not believe anybody would turn down a network television special. I just did it because I wanted to pull his tail.
Mm-hmm.
And he responded so elegantly. Well, the bottom line is we actually wound up in New York, and we wound up with a conversation that led to 2 hours, of which I had a fairly good chunk. The only thing that was missing in those 2 hours was they never showed you really what we found. So, this morning, first for your eyes, you're going to see what Robin and I went climbing up and down a locked pyramid in the dark, freezing our tails off, to bring to you. So, we went first to Teotihuacan. Now, remember, it's television. in the show. Remember how Lester said, oh, my hope, and then that goes it. No, no, we did it backwards. We went to take you a conference, then we went to Guatemala. You can't trust television. You cannot trust television. First rule, do not trust television. Doesn't mean you don't watch it, but you have to correlate it with other data inputs as you do the net. I mean, the net is an amazing tool, just don't trust it. Don't trust one website, don't trust one source, don't trust one blog. You've got to sift, you have to, and it makes it so easy now. Anybody can do this. Anybody can do this. It's a shame we don't teach kids in school how to really use the net, although I haven't been into a class yet in computer science recently that actually showed what they're doing with kids, but based on some kids that I know, they don't know how to use the web as a tool for really finding stuff out. And that should be something that in the next push for education, we bring a lot of kids back in the 21st century, because the web is our global library. If you know how to use it, it's an exquisite tool. I could not do what Enterprise does in opposition to the U.S. government and God knows who else.
Number five.
Issues of the U.S. government and God knows who else, unless we have the web to use. Anyway, so we went to Teotihuacan. This is the layout. And one of the things you need to understand is that Teotihuacan, big, big surprise, is laid out with redundant 19.5s all over the place. Starting with this location. It's at 19.5 on the planet. And Harleston, when he did his surveying work in the 1970s, found that it was an exquisite representation of the circumscribed tetrahedron in the rotating sphere. I mean, what more does one need to get one really asking, what did they know, and when did they know it? Mm-hmm. So, there we are, before dawn, after dawn, at noon, scrambling up and down this structure. The one right here. This is the pyramid of the sun. And this is obviously a helicopter shot, so you're seeing the pyramid of the moon projected by trekking all the way up here in the dark, freezing cold. She was trying to take notes in the dark, and her fingers were so cold that she couldn't write with a pen. Now, that doesn't really show up on camera. The fact that she looked a little blue, that should be a clue, but we got to the top, and we're there with Jaime Masson. Now, the other thing I didn't like about the special is it didn't go into Jaime's extraordinary broadcast journalism credits. Mm-hmm. It basically said, oh, this is a UFO guy from Mexico. Mm-hmm. Jaime is anchor, or was anchor, of the equivalent of CBS 60 Minutes in Mexico on, I think it's Azteca, which is the major Mexican network, mm-hmm. for decades. Mm-hmm. He had done an extraordinary series on Teotihuacan, investigating all the measurements and the mythology and the history and all that, which he sent me, and I sent those DVDs on to the producers in New York. Not one mentioned that he was probably the world's best expert in Teotihuacan based on his journalism inquiries, having nothing to do with guys up there. But of course, television has a spin. When you watch television, the first thing you have to say to yourself, as Gene Roddenberry told me, is, what are they trying to sell? That's the first question you should ask when you watch television. Once you ask that question, then you can watch what they are trying to sell you and calibrate against the other stuff that you need to put into the equation. So there we are on this. By the way, I used to have a fear of heights. Anyway, so there we are, measuring. Here's the little gadget you're using to measure. This is a little Accutron, which is basically on a sensor designed by my friend Bill Halley. We're measuring this using the laptop to basically record all the data, and this is how it works. The Accutron was, as Bulova said back in 65 when they invented this thing, the first revolutionary advance in timekeeping in 300 years. And the reason for that was, instead of having a spring-wound escapement, the thing that goes click, 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 it had a little tuning fork located right here. And the tuning fork vibrates back and forth at 360 cycles per second is a better view. And what happens is, the frequency standard set by the tuning fork is then used to run the escapement, to turn the hand so you can actually read time. Well, this was all very well and good
until NASA quietly discovered that the Iacotron was not very accurate. When they put it into their spacecraft, they even had Scott Carpenter holding a watch up on his wrist on the cover of Harry Max magazine back in the 60s. And then a few months later, NASA quietly took all the Iacotrons out of their spacecraft, never telling anybody. Decades later, I figured out the problem. The problem is this. This is a frequency plot. Time is this way. Frequency is this way. By the way, high frequencies are down on the graph. Low frequencies are up. Don't ask me why they wrote the program that way. I didn't write it, but I just use it. And sometimes I put it upside down so that up is up and down is down. So every time you see a down squiggle, it means a higher frequency. And an up squiggle means a lower frequency. Well, look at the Iacotron. It's not constant at all. When you see some actual numbers here in the moment, you're going to see how imprecise and inconstant it is. That was a stunning, stunning clue to how this could be used as a sensor. Here's the data. This is the pyramid of the sun, where Robin and I were at dawn. And this is the dawn measurement. Look, the standard is 360. That's roughly what it is. It went up to 454, then it went up to 465. Just at sunrise, as the Earth is tangential to the rising sun, rotating on a rotating planet, aligned, et cetera, et cetera, the frequency went boing! And as you can see, it had all kinds of structure. And it did it twice. First here, and then here. Now, without laboratory baseline, without comparative, you know, we should actually do this a lot of mornings in a row. We'll get probably some warmer clothes. Maybe gloves. But this is an amazing reading, given that, remember, under standard physics, under standard Newtonian or relativistic equations, nothing like this should be happening. That little tuning fork should be vibrating back and forth, very happy at 360 cycles per second, coming along, not changing at all. Mm-hmm. The fact that on the top of the pyramid of the sun at dawn, this thing went crazy, mm-hmm. to me, was one of those eureka aha moments. And wouldn't it have been nice if this graph had made it into a cycle? I think the reasoning there was, oh, it's too complex for general audience. This is why television is both your friend and not your friend.
Right.
And again, here's the tuning fork itself. Something, now there's only two ways to change the frequency of that tuning fork. One is if you somehow change the current in those little magnets, make the current stronger, it'll vibrate faster. Make the current weaker, it'll vibrate slower. There's nothing that will change the current sitting on top of a pile of stone in the middle of nowhere, a place called Teotihuacan. The other is it's the mass of the tuning fork itself, the inertia, the resistance to being pushed, which is the definition of mass, change. And that, of course, is a total revolution. Now we go to Tikal. Look at what we got at Tikal. I'm sitting up here. I climbed a lot of pyramids in this trip. Lots of pyramids. I'm sitting up here, and all hell is breaking loose. Look at the change. 65-to-1 frequency shift. The lowest frequency was down around 14, 15 cycles per second. Remember, this is for a little thing that wants to vibrate at 360. There's even a transistorized feedback circuit designed to try to help it stay at 360. And that circuit completely is blown away by the changes of the mass of the tuning fork. Now, the reason this is so important is because the back and forth motion of a tuning fork is essentially rotation. And the crucial part, which they did not put in, Rebecca did not for some reason put it in, they gave her lots and lots of sound bites, and I'm sure I said it several different ways, is that if that little tuning fork mass can change, sitting on top of a pyramid in Mexico, in obligation to the first three laws of hyperdimensional torsion physics, rotation, 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 then obviously it means that a rotating system such as the Earth itself is also subject to mass and inertia changes in terms of its rotation. That's the that right there sets up the stage, sets up the backdrop for the possibility that indeed, on 2012 or thereabouts, under the appropriate background hyperdimensional torsion field conditions, the motion of the Earth could be interrupted and could in fact change in a very dramatic way. The science does not preclude that now. It opens that doorway. Now, given that I was supposed to be the doom and gloom guy, you would think that they would have wanted to make that point really clear. Back to the physics of how this works. This is, of course, a projection of the precessional plot. It shows you, in fact, how the world rotates and revolves around the sun, and over this 26,000-year period, how it also wobbles. It's called precession. And it produces this celestial panorama in the sky where the north pole of the Earth is named at different constellations in the course of this 26,000 years. Now, the key part of all this is that we're in a galaxy with 400 billion stars, all of which have a torsion field, including the big guy, the 4 million solar mass black hole. That's what it is.
Part 5.
Six.
The center of the galaxy. The solar system also has various objects. This alignment, this resonant alignment, if in fact you propose that there are some unseen guys out here which get into just the right position to contribute their part in the frequency pattern, that could be the cliche is the straw that breaks the camel's back. In fact, if those things are synchronized, if there is a resonance between the orbit of the unseen planets and the alignment of the precessional Earth on the solstice with the galactic center, it's those two effects together which could, well, end everything that we know. And again, it is important, it behooves us to find out. Because in the worst case scenario, this would not be good, as Carl used to tell me, for beagles or begonias. Remember, we live on a world that is covered with water. Not as deep as the oceans of Europa, but it's deep enough. If you move the Earth, and you don't change all the constants in exactly the same phase synchronization to 0.00000000, however long you want that decimal string to run, the differential changes means you get what I call the bathtub effect. And we all know what that means. And that means a major motion picture for Roman memory, right? Which, of course, brought up this set of questions, which I thought was dealt with pretty fairly in Rebecca's special. And this was the watchword for Embridge Stone. How would the governments of our planet prepare 6 billion people to the end of the world? Answer, they would. And that's just absolutely true. There's no way you would tell people this is what's coming, particularly if in your Newtonian world, in your Einsteinian relativistic perspective, there wasn't a damn thing you could do about it anyway. So why would you tell anybody? Because there is no safe place. If you're imagining there's a safe place to live on the Earth, if this happens, no, you basically, as Russian love would say, bend over and... So, this, by the way, was the trailer. Now, Ron and I have not seen the film. Anybody here, how many have seen the film? Okay. All right, well, don't spoil it for all the rest of us who are really looking forward to going and watch the world then. Okay. But I understand from certain esteemed critics that it's not bad. That, in fact, Roland does pull it off. He really makes the end of the world interesting. Yeah. Only in America. All right. So the concept of 2012, to me, is inexorably connected with, is it possible that everything could change? Mm-hmm. And again, that's tabulated to what could happen in terms of an alignment with the center of the galaxy, which is here. On December 21, if you're hiding behind the Earth in a spacecraft, looking, peeking over the North Pole, this is what you'd see. Here's the Earth, North Pole here, Sun here, And the Galactic Center is located right about there. Okay? Now, the critics say, oh, well, this happens every year, you know, why is it a big deal? Answer, another X factor. The other planets and the synchronization of orbits, resonance in the physics, or in this case, dissonance, causing the Earth to want to change that parameter, change that rotational axis. Which, of course, as I just noted, led us to here. These things are amazing, by the way. And they're so perfectly formed. I was really astonished with how modern looking the architecture was. It almost looked like something out of, I don't know, Star Wars. Which, of course, is where George Lucas went to shoot his scenes in Star Wars. These readings are so important because they are the first scientific evidence that in fact mass can change. And if mass can change on a rotating world, it means that this kind of interaction, this kind of interference pattern, this tremor in the force, in fact could precipitate things that we really, really, really do not want to experience.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, one of the things about the special that I was really intrigued with is how Michael Shermer, who is our resident skeptic, blatantly and casually dismissed motion field physics as something I had made up, you know, sitting in my pajamas in my basement typing
really
on
good.
The internet. In fact, his direct quote was, there's no such thing as motion physics. Well, Michael obviously has not read the work of this guy, who under the Bushies was a high-level administrator in the Department of Defense and wrote for Tim Ventura's website a really amazing review of torsion field physics. For among other things, he talked about how you can create torsion fields, let me back up here, with plasmas. That's the polar aurora that the Hopi are talking about in terms of the warriors holding the snake. Does aurora look like snakes? As well as what happens with rotating bodies when they're exposed to adjacent rotating bodies, these spin fields, according to this DOD guy, can influence each other. And we live on a rotating body, right? In a solar system of other rotating bodies, in a galaxy of rotating, in other words, there is a real science here that we could and must pay attention to. Which brings us back, of course, to the special. One of the other things I was really gratified that they did do positively was that they included this amazing story. This is Major Maynard White, who was the head of, even though he was only a major, and they picked him because he had B-29 experience and mapping experience, and we'll see why that was important in a second. They picked him to head the first operational squadron of the newly formed Strategic Air Command under the newly formed, going to be newly formed, because this was actually done in 46. They didn't change the nomenclature until 47, but would ultimately become the Department of Defense. Then it was the War Department. So it was the Army Air Corps in the War Department was tasked through this guy to basically, from this building, take a squadron of aircraft and map the polar regions, setting up parameters for the dew line, the pine tree line, all our early warning systems, because we were terrified in those days that the Earth was going to be overwhelmed, not by a full ship, but by bad Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Those nasty Soviet commies were going to come across the pole, you know, undermine all our...
I can see them from my backyard.
With just about as much basis as that. What was interesting is that in the middle of this book, which was written by Ken White, who is Maynard White's son, called World in Peril, which I think came by way of, well, there's a long history as to how I got this book. And I'm not going to go into it. I've been told I can't go into how I got this book. So I'm just going to have to leave you with a mystery. How did Hovind know enough to get this book and read it? Because it was given to me, yes, yes. Now, Robin gave it to me, but she doesn't want me to tell her how she knows anymore. Anyway, buried in the middle of what looks like a very dull, dry, geopolitical treatise on the Cold War And if there are 2,000 and some books written on Kennedy's death, there are millions that have been written on the Cold War. So, like, who needed another book on the Cold War to read? Well, because it was given to me by Robin, I dutifully started to read. And then in the middle of this book, I found the MacGuffin. That as part of their mapping, as part of their polar surveys, the 46th 72nd Squadron under Maynard White has found earth-shaking scientific discoveries. Okay. Such as, if you read the prologue, which I won't let you read, he says here that we'll reshape our planet and have a profound impact on our global society. And again, I'm wondering, is this just metaphorical, geopolitical language? Because, you know, those Air Force brats, they grew up in that culture, and you kind of breathe and sleep and eat it, and ultimately it winds up to be techno-speak in a geopolitical sense. However, as I read further, I discovered that as part of these reconnaissances, because you cannot use compasses in the polar regions. You're so close to the magnetic poles of the North and South Pole that you have to devise another navigation system totally, and they actually devised a system, invented it under Maynard White, called the Grid System, which is even used now by all commercial airline pilots all over the world when they're in the polar region. They have to use a grid mapping system because the magnetic compasses, and this was in the days before such things as inertial nav systems, which are basically tied into the inertia of rotating.
Whoa, next.
Systems, gyroscopes, and accelerometers, and stuff like that. They had none of that stuff. So it was basically using star sites, sun sites, a grid mapping system, and not using magnetic compasses. And they found, near the North Pole, that something pretty amazing had happened. As they're looking into the limits of the magnetic compass, they found that deep inside the Earth, yes, you have the equivalent of a bar magnet, although that's not exactly what's going on, produces what's called a dipole field, you know, like a simple magnet, except they found that the dipole had moved from 1831 when it was located here. The new magnetic North Pole in 1948 was located here. A 200-mile change. Then, to read further, in chapter 28, Ken finally gets around to the reason that he, with his dad, wrote the book. Because their conclusion was there was going to be a potential cataclysm coming when the magnetic pole, which was moving toward the North Pole, coincided with the North Pole, and then literally all hell would break loose. How do they know this? Because they set up in the Pentagon a set of study groups, which are reported on in this book. And in this, they talk specifically about the flip of the Earth. And they set up a contract with Dr. Paul Seipel, who was a big polar explorer back in those eras. And it was at the Rand Corporation. It wasn't at the Remington Rand Corporation. Ken got the typewriter company confused. Paul Seipel was an amazing guy, an amazing scientist. He actually was commissioned by the Pentagon to do a series of laboratory experiments in what would happen with rotating spheres when they had electrified cores that were separate and those cores were moving relative to the surface, and what would happen when they coincide with the actual axis of the rotating outer sphere. Again, technical language, all hell broke loose. The spheres violently flipped and produced a new equilibrium and then rotated like the Earth does now. But when you extrapolate up to the size of the planet, that would mean the end of most living things on the surface until new things could evolve that would be suited to the new condition. What was very interesting to me, and was not covered in the book, we didn't have time to cover it in the special, and we will in future months when I put together some television on this myself, is that Seipel came back from Operation Nanook, which is what they called this operation, for the Strategic Air Command, and immediately got an expedition approved by President Truman, launched headed by Admiral Byrd, taking 4,000 men to the South Pole in a 13-ship flotilla. Suddenly, on an emergency basis, and when you Google Operation Hike Up and read the details, it's clear to me now that somebody was suddenly very, very worried about what was going on at the South Pole. And that's another stated, unsaid part of this story. We still haven't cleaned out all that was going on. I do have one anecdotal comment that Truman, because of funding and because he was not very popular in polls and all that, he was basically not going to send the expedition at all. And on the Sunday before they were scheduled to leave, like a day or so before they were scheduled to leave, Byrd and I think Forrestal, who was Secretary of Defense then, it wasn't Secretary of Defense, it was still Secretary of War. And a couple of the people had a meeting with him in the Oval Office, and when they came out of the meeting, Truman had suddenly agreed to Operation High Jump. Even though going in, he was dead set against it. So what did they show him? What did they tell him that made him change his mind? Those questions are behind all of this. So now, here's a plot of where the magnetic pole has gone from the 1800s all the way to 2005, which is the last data we have here. This is an extrapolation of from 2005 to 2010. I haven't found 2009 yet. I'm still looking. But that data may not be readily accessible, particularly if this has taken a turn and is heading. This is a stunning thing. A lot of people in Washington are extremely concerned because, and this is one of the conclusions, they debated in 48 in the Pentagon whether they would actually alert the public to this. And he's very diplomatic, but basically the conclusion was that they couldn't agree to do it or not to do it. They did nothing. And we have been living for 60 plus years in delightful ignorance as to the science that was measured in the field, indicating that something big is going on with the Earth, with the planet, that we are not supposed to know about. Why? Because of this. This sounds, by the way, eerily like Brookings. This is almost exactly the language of Brookings. We can't tell people that there are artifacts on the moon or Mars or Venus because it might destroy the moral fabric of society. Scientists would no longer get up in the morning trying to figure things out because they just ran into an ancient culture and knew everything. Why should they bother? That kind of thing. I think, of course, there's a much more fundamental economic and social reason, which is they do not want things to change. They want things to go on as if life is normal because they need the economic impact. They're going to change the lives of some people if they're going to save the lives of some people. Because saving all of 6 billion, as Emmerich said in the film, is probably impossible. Unless, and there's one important caveat to that, which I'll get to momentarily, unless you figure out a way to keep it from happening at all. That's the only rational thing we can look at this data now. That's that. We must figure out a way to stop it from happening. Fortunately, in the physics, there is precisely such a mechanism. Now, Ed Truman was very interesting. It turns out that he probably knows a lot more, or knew a lot more about this problem than anybody has dared to write up to now. But he was never president. With backing of the people in this place, which of course is the Pentagon, have known that something kind of bad could be on the horizon unless something was done. And the last president who was in a position to know and then to do something and do it rather overtly was in fact this guy on the end, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now Truman set up this whole history of the Earth beginning in 1946-47. We had a series of confrontations with the Soviet Union. We had their atomic bomb test. We had our atomic bomb test. We had a Cold War to launch where, you know, duck and cover became de rigueur for every kid in America. We have countless scholarly references and studies and tomes written on the creation of the national security state, which of course is the one we're living under, which only was amplified and hyped to an almost unbelievable level with the events of 9/11. Well, it is my theory, my model, that in fact the entire set of world events over the last 60 years, every facet of the Cold War, including the war on terror now, exists in fact as a cover for what they have been really using these resources, trillions of dollars of resources to prepare for, which is the worst case scenario for 2012. And if that's correct, it means the next few months, the next 2 years are going to be extraordinarily interesting. What was interesting to me is that the morning after our special aired, NASA came out and attacked the whole idea of 2012 itself. Now in Washington, there's a kind of rule of thumb. If someone is beneath your notice, if they're, you know, fleas on the dog, if they're basically espousing a political point of view, which you think is not only wrong, but not even in the right ballpark, the last thing you do is take aim and help so they become an equal opposition voice. NASA, on the Monday after the special, elevated 2012 to an equal opposition voice, and anyone who is seriously investigating this set of parameters. And my feeling is, I can't prove it yet, but my feeling is, because of all the 2012 specials which have been done, we were fighting against two others that night, one on the side, one on History Channel, no, Discovery and National Geographic, both had 2012 specials the same night as Sci-Fi did. We have the higher numbers, by the way. Our specials beat them out, hands down, in terms of rating. The only important point about television, of course. It was the only special Air Force discovery that in fact the world could end as we know it. And laying it out. Remember how much the whole thing, when we called the Pentagon and there was no comment? Well, the worst thing you can do in Washington these days is to say no comment, because immediately people think, why are they hiding? Why aren't they going to comment? They didn't say, oh, it's nonsense or it's crazy. They basically said no comment, which preserves the option for finding a memo at some point saying, oh yeah, we really did do this and we looked at that, the way the game in Washington is played. So I believe our special, which was my highest hope, actually reached to the highest levels of government, and the response the next morning was a NASA website. This, by the way, is what the NASA website looks like. You can actually go to this. And it says things like, oh, 2012, beginning of the end, or why the world won't end, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It has elevated this to a level of official discussion. Now, in my heart of heart, I think that this is a very brilliant strategy. I will lay out the reasoning for this in the second part of this in a couple of minutes. I think this is a very brilliant strategy on the part of the current denizen of that building. Because remember, NASA is now President Obama's NASA.
Right.
The administrator of NASA is Major General Marine Charlie Bolden, who is Obama's NASA administrator. If you think in terms of reverse logic, and you want everyone to kind of focus on the problem of 2012, having yourself photographed in front of the Mayan and Aztec calendar, and having your NASA say it's all nonsense, so everybody, of course, says, why are they saying it's nonsense, is a very interesting development in this history. This man, I think, knew exactly everything I've told you and then some, and I'm hoping the next thing will show you what else he knew. Because we find this man, who is now the occupant of the Oval Office, looking at this picture of that man.
That's right.
And it is my firm belief that presidency of Barack Obama is Kennedy Part 2. And one of my key reasons for saying that is that one of Barack Obama's quiet, intimate counselors is in fact Ted Sorensen, who was the alter ego of John Kennedy and wrote those brilliant speeches. And Kennedy over and over again admitted that basically he and Ted were brothers, you know, separated at birth or something, and it was almost cosmic how they came together and they created what they created in the brief time that the Kennedy administration was in operation. Kennedy chose as his vice presidential running mate Lyndon Johnson, a figure which will play a larger role as we get toward the end of this story, and he exemplified, Kennedy did, an inordinate interest in things celestial. What we find is a real paradox in the record. We find repeated statements that he doesn't care about space, he doesn't care about going to the moon, he doesn't care about this, he doesn't care about that. And yet everything he does amplifies and exaggerates and accelerates humankind's movement into the cosmos and the acquisition of crucial celestial information, which goes far and above the standard Cold War paradigm of the time or any of the historical records. I do not think the real record, the real understanding of the interest of this man in, this is John Glenn and him looking into John's Mercury 7 spacecraft. I don't think anyone has begun to touch on the reason why John Kennedy sent us to this place in 1969.
Yep.
Why in 1961 on May 25th, he stood in the well of the House of Representatives in Washington to a joint session of Congress and enunciated the Apollo project and used language that I find very interesting. Now is the time to take longer strides, time for a great new American enterprise, I'll put that line, time for this nation to take a leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think, as Mike and I said in Dark Mission, that those words were mere metaphors. In fact, I believe that the ultimate reason for Apollo, for this new young president to commit this nation to an unprecedented journey, to take the whole world with them, metaphorically speaking, and to get something and bring it home, was all because of the looming and impending and inexorably approaching 2012 problem. And my mission this morning is to prove that to you beyond a reasonable doubt. So let's see if I can do that. So here we have this young president. You can see how much he loved being president. He's there in the Oval Office in the first few days of his presidency in 1961. And yet we know that from the moment he took off, including the meetings he had in Vienna with Chairman Khrushchev, one of the things that he tried to do over and over again, and we now know this because of Ted Sorensen's book called Counselor, which is that thick and sitting on my coffee table, and I have not had time to read most of it, but I did read a couple parts that completely verified some inclinations I had made based on the data we published in Dark Mission. It turns out that he, Kennedy, and Khrushchev struck up a secret dialogue that lasted his entire presidency. Remember, these are two men who control nuclear stockpiles, which either one can incinerate the world. And they came within a whisker of doing so during the October missile crisis in 1962. These men were in constant contact without anyone, of course, except for the CIA, knowing. And obviously the CIA viewed these contacts as incredibly inimical to national security. In fact, they were inimical to the continuation of the Cold War, which was in someone's interest to foster and accelerate to the level we now have seen, now proceeding into the War on Terror, because of other agendas not in consonance with the stated reason that we might be concerned, either bad commies or bad terrorists. In Counselor, Sorensen revealed that Kennedy set up a kind of semi-regular drop. In the spy business, it's called a nail drop. And what he would do is there would be a Russian KGB agent standing on a corner in downtown Washington holding a copy of the Washington Post under his arm. And Sorensen would come up to him and quietly give him a letter from the president And the KGB agent would quietly take a letter out from the Washington Post and hand it to Sorensen. And then put Sorensen's letter from the president into the Washington Post and walk off down the street in downtown Washington. This is how these two men, without any other intermediate filters, communicated about the state of the world at the height of the Cold War, man to man, without the interference of the KGB, the CIA, the State Department, or any other personnel. And Sorensen confirms this high-level communication between John Kennedy and Khrushchev from the beginning of Kennedy assuming the presidency. Ultimately, winding up with an extraordinary rapprochement, a meeting of the mind, to where when you read some scholarly papers, like this one called The Kennedy Experiment by a scholar at Columbia University, Kennedy's idea was that he would be able to talk down the Soviet Union from a nuclear war posture by little things, evidencing trust in this area, trust in that area, probably leading to trust in the big area, which is how do we stop from annihilating mankind with 100,000 nuclear warheads, 50,000 on each side. There was a moment in September of 1963, September 20th, I believe, where Kennedy took this idea to the United Nations. That's Secretary General Lugan there on the web. And he gave an astonishing speech, which has now been verified in terms of its impact by this gentleman, who is Sergei Khrushchev, who was Premier Khrushchev's lone surviving son. He's a scholar, I think, at Brown University now. The bottom line was that Khrushchev said on a people.
Don, can you call Beth? She dropped.
Oops. Want to play song?
Oh, I'm gonna go to part 9.
Okay, here we go. Keep it on.
Khrushchev said on a PBS special a few years ago that the Cold War might have ended in 1969. An American astronaut and a Soviet cosmonaut might have stepped onto the lunar surface together.
Yeah.
Because what Kennedy has been trying to do with Khrushchev for the entire length of his presidency, Cold War rock notwithstanding, race to the moon against the bad commies notwithstanding, competition between the free world and the totalitarian world notwithstanding, he was determined to get Khrushchev to go to the moon together. And that, of course, is in total violation of all of the history that we have been told. Now, there are some evidences in the record, for instance, this Red and White magazine, showing technically how it might even be done. We have various memos. This one, a National Security Memorandum from November 12, 1963. Memorandum number 271, where he specifically is asking James Webb, who was the head of NASA, to get ready for intimate cooperation with the Soviet Union, with the Russians, with the astronautics program of the Soviet Union, so ultimately they could wind up going to the moon together. Well, 12 days later, a brief window, John Kennedy is killed. And his colleague, his partner in architecting a global cooperation that would change competition into cooperation, into sharing of what humans discovered on the moon as part of a joint project representing all of humankind, he is sidelined to his Dacha outside Moscow, and spends the next year basically sitting in a rocker on the floor under house arrest by the KGB. So forces on both sides of the Iron Curtain move, in our view, to eliminate the possibility that Khrushchev and Kennedy would do this grand thing together, and thereby perpetuated the Cold War another generation, another 20 years, which, as we now see, has morphed into the fall of the wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, has morphed into a new war, which we're all caught up in, which is obsessing us and is focusing all our attention when there are real problems in the background, that we're not being allowed to even knowledge, let alone pay attention to. In this precept from the memo, this is the part that I really wanted to emphasize. It says right here, including cooperation in lunar landing programs. Right there in black and white. This is not theory. This is not a wild idea. This is historical fact. It did not happen because some people did not want it to happen. Now, if it had occurred, you know, leap forward in time. This is a picture of Gene Cernan standing next to the American flag, a Taurus litter on the moon. Classic picture, right? Genre Americans, American flag, American astronauts, NASA symbology, Earth hanging in the sky. Oh, there is one other little detail. If you look closely in this sky, you'll see this. And if you focus in on this, you'll see that it's a pair of incredible double prisms, which in an airless lunar sky in a vacuum is impossible. The reason is that as light is refracted through optically, you know, transparent materials like glass, it forms differential refraction, red, green, blue, etc., etc. On the moon, we find that there is a stunning set of chrome in the sky. It's not John Lear's atmosphere. It is the remains of an ancient set of geometric glass-like domes, and those domes are giving us exquisite rainbows, which when you look, you can see the effect along the horizon. Just like sunrise and sunset have wonderful color effects, this glass set of structures on the moon gives you prismatic dispersion of color at sunrise and sunset, and when the astronaut walks to take pictures, the horizon material moves because of parallax to shift to the astronaut's perspective. This is impossible under any normal reconstruction of what NASA said is really on the moon. This is what I think Kennedy wanted to share. He started out, in my belief, going along with the party line. So we had to go to the moon, if we had to get information, you're going to see what the information was supposed to lead to. And then at some point, he realized there was stuff there. Amazing, astonishing structures. And that it was too big to contain within one country. That it would in fact precipitate the very nuclear war he was trying to prevent. And the only way he could possibly get this done in a way that would save everyone would be if he included the Soviet Union, the most powerful competition, competitor, on the other side of the world. And then I found this, which I find kind of interesting in the context of what we are talking about. So, this man, how did he possibly know in 1963, because you're going to see that's an important date in a moment, how did he know there was stuff there? Well, because the CIA set up a satellite reconnaissance program in 1960 called Corona. It was a series of high-resolution film cameras in Earth orbit looking down at the Soviet Union, taking photographs of missile bases and all the stuff like that. But Corona went through several iterations. Some of the technical background. This is photographs of the Pentagon taken with Corona. You can see what amazing things you can see. Well, what you don't realize, and no one realizes unless you point it out to them, is that you can also turn the camera and look up. Yes. You can use the same spy satellites to look at the moon.
Yes.
And in fact, we now have data showing that when you turn high-resolution Earth assets toward the moon and take a close-up look, you in fact not only begin to puncture the NASA connections to 2012, you also begin to realize that there is stuff on the moon that you can see from Earth orbit with the appropriate national assets, i.e. spy satellites. You don't even have to go to the moon. How do I know this? Because in the revised edition of Dark Mission, Mike Vera and I have published three sets of images taken of the moon by amateur astronomers now with amateur technology, CCDs and telescopes, small telescopes, 14 inches, something like that, which show astonishing artificial structures on the moon that you can see from Earth. And if they can be seen with amateurs in the 1990s and 2000s in the 21st century, with the CIA spy satellite assets that Kennedy had at his disposal, it is not a stretch to imagine that in fact they saw this data on those images. Which brings us, of course, back for the whole 2012 problem. Because in 2012, as we said before, the Earth aligns very nicely. So that if you're sitting here, you look across the sun, or high noon, and on the other side of where the Earth would be in June, way out here, some 26,000 light years away, is the center of the galaxy. Now, that's kind of a code. That alignment, if you're trying to provide a symbolic code for what could happen, that alignment code is very important. Well, it turns out that this is the geometry of the galaxy. Here's the Milky Way, here's the Sun, here's some of the stars in the Sun's vicinity. This is the Orion Nebula, here's Betelgeuse, Rigel, the Crab Nebula, Star Sirius. They're all part of the Orion complex. Now, notice, here's the center of the galaxy. Here is the Orion complex, which is exactly 180 degrees away. This is a radial plot of the galaxy's hydrogen, taken from one of the recent surveys. And you can see here's the galactic center. Here are the various spiral arms of the Milky Way tabulated. This one is called the Orion Arm for a good reason. Because when you look directly away from the galactic center out in intergalactic space, lo and behold, you are looking in the direction of Orion. Mm-hmm. Now, why is Orion important? Oh, why is Orion important? Orion not only is a physical constellation, an astonishingly beautiful physical constellation. Here are the three belt stars. Here's the so-called sword. Here's the Orion Nebula. This is Betelgeuse. This is Rigel, Bellatrix. Anyway, the point is that Orion, for some reason, which you'll see in Dark Mission, became associated intimately in the NASA mythology with the pyramids. And we now know that the pyramids from Robert Laval's work are lined up at Giza almost exactly, I mean really exactly, mimicking the belt stars of the constellation of Orion. And on December 21, on 2012, there is this wonderful alignment between the Giza shaft, those long, thin corridors that extend out from the King's Chamber right to the center, to the surface of the pyramid, with the belt stars of Orion. Again, echoing this important geometry. This is now another graphical way to show this. On December 21, 2012, the alignment is exact. On that night, if you look at noon, across the sun at high noon, you'll be looking toward the center of the galaxy. If you turn around and look at midnight on the same night, you're looking directly at Orion. That, of course, shows up in, of all things, the official logo of Kennedy's Apollo program to the moon. This is a NASA patch. This, when I saw this finally and realized what it all meant, it was like, oh my God, it's the Emily Dickinson thing again. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Unless you have the background, unless you have the context, you're not going to figure this stuff out. Well, it gets even better. Because in 2004, this president suddenly says, we got to go back to the moon. Oh my God, we've got to go back to the moon. And he initiates at NASA headquarters in January, an amazing program called Project Constellation. Well, Constellation, besides all this cute stuff, you know, the NASA logo and, you know, Earth, Moon, Mars, it's got the three belt stars of Orion, and this represents, of course, the Orion Nebula. Orion, oh, and by the way, notice this. This is important, okay? Because they then call the key spacecraft that's going to succeed the shuttle, surprise, surprise, Orion. And when you do this little number, you look at the NASA logo. Now, why is this important? Because in the Egyptian, Orion is really Osiris, the god of resurrection and death in the Egyptian mythology, which has to do with cycles. You die and then you're reborn. Lion Osiris is the god. Well, in Egyptian, it's not spelled Osiris or Lion, it's spelled Asar. A-S-A-R. So every time you see an A, I mean, look at this. This is Asar. Saying, reiterating that in fact Asar is Osiris, is Orion. And we find in the NASA logo, I always wondered about the NASA logo, and then I had a kind of an insight from a film that was done by Jose Escamilla. Probably the only important useful thing in the entire film was someone pointed out that this symbol, in fact, is this. It's another A. NASA itself is dedicated to Orion, to Osiris, to Asar, and to the alignment of Orion as a celestial clock that marks midnight, December 21, 2012. So, in essence, NASA is an agency devoted to 2012. No wonder the morning after our special they came out and attacked. They had to. Someone was so bright and wanted us to connect the dots and everybody else to connect the dots, because you don't do that in Washington unless, in fact, you want to do exactly the opposite of what you're doing. And the guy behind doing the opposite is Barack Obama, because it is NASA now and his space agency and his agenda, whatever that agenda is. At least that's my model, and I'm looking at how the dots connect. And science is nothing if it's not prediction, so you predict what happens next. What's going to happen next is going to be an amazing set of revelations from Obama vis-a-vis NASA through Charlie Bolden in the next few months concerning mind-blowing stuff. And that's about all I can say, because I don't have any more time to say anything more until we do the next conference, and then I'll tell you more of the story. Now, where this meets the road is the physics. Remember, the physics is symbolically represented by entwined tetrahedra, representing the force structure in rotating planets, merging at 19.5, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, isn't it interesting that if you put the Orion logo of the new missions back to the moon, by the way, Constellation has got to refer to Orion, what could you possibly have called a program Constellation without really giving it away, except that it had to be Orion? When you do this, you wind up with that. So at every level, the connection between Giza, the cosmic clock, the countdown to 2012, the alignment, celestial alignment, which is your ultimate cosmic clock, and NASA's overwhelming fascination with Egyptian mythology and with the representations of what's going on the plateau, it all comes together in this symbology over and over and over again, which of course is why NASA had to come out the morning after the special and say, those guys are nuts. Except they didn't have to. By doing that, they have elevated the discussion and forced a lot of people who would never even have given them second thought begin to ask the question that we ask in the book, what did NASA know and when did it know it about 2012? Well, my thesis today is that NASA itself was formed as an agency by Eisenhower, the intermediate president between Truman, who first figured out we got a problem, Houston, Eisenhower, who set in motion the International Geophysical Year and set up NASA and all that. And then John Kennedy, whose job it was to take all this, put it together, and begin an active plan to do something to change what otherwise could potentially occur. That's the model. And then, because he was going to share this with the Russians, those evil, nasty communists that the CIA could not stand, and we'll get to why they couldn't stand them in a minute.
No.
He was killed in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, 46 years ago tomorrow. Does the story end there? No. Because this is the piece. This is, if you take away nothing else from this morning, this is what I want you to take away. If Apollo's all-in-the-dark mission was indeed to bring back exotic technology from the moon, to somehow save the Earth in 2012, was Kennedy's belated discovery of this, i.e. NASA's real motivation for Apollo, the hidden reason the president quietly decided to turn around and share the lunar program with our enemy, only a few months after his high-profile congressional announcement, and thus did those equally secret protracted negotiations with Nikita Khrushchev over Soviet participation in Apollo for those 3 long years, his entire administration, we now know from Sorensen, with this back and forth dialogue. When Khrushchev finally said yes, which was on November 12th, '63, how do we know this? Because of his son, Sergei, says that's when that happened. And that's when the NSC memos are written to Webb from Kennedy. Is that, in fact, why he was killed? And my answer is yes. But it gets more intriguing. Because John Kennedy tried to tell everyone in an extraordinarily symbolic way what he was doing while he was doing it, and that message is still going on, and it's right in front of us, and we never really noticed and understood what it meant, and it all has to do with Air Force One. Now, the standard story is that the design of Air Force One, or the redesign, actually, the color scheme and all that, came about because of Jackie Kennedy and her interest in redecorating the White House, and, you know, she was this, you know, good little wifey who was doing the decorating thing, and, you know, her decorating thing extended to the airplane and the image and Camelot and all that. History actually is quite a bit more interesting. As I started looking at this, and I'll tell you bluntly what got me intrigued. What got me intrigued was the fact that Eisenhower had a 707 from Boeing and flew around under the Military Air Transport Service, MATS. And it was the Air Force who did keep the president safe and the flying here and flying there and all that. And he flew in a plane like this, which had bright orange silver markings, Air Force markings all over it. And the word is that Kennedy thought this was too regal. He wanted to do something that was more democratic, something more in touch with the history of the United States. So he basically said to Jackie, you know, do something with the airplane. That's the story. I found out something quite a bit more intriguing and different. Because if you start looking at the tail numbers of these aircraft, you begin to see a pattern. The thing that really caught my eye was this. That really caught my eye was this. What is that? That is the precessional cycle of the planet Earth.
26,000.
On the tail of the most famous Air Force One that has ever existed. Now, was that an accident? Or was it something else? So I began to, as Cooper says over and over again, dig deeper. And what I found was a listing through the various Air Force One sites, sponsored by the Air Force and all these, you know, aviation groups. It's a, you know, the web is an amazing tool. You can find anything if you just know how to look. You find a sequence of tail numbers. These are tail numbers from the Eisenhower years, the first 3 707s that were given in 59 to the White House for use as presidential aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. And then you come down to John Kennedy, which is here. And the tail numbers go 6970, 6971, 6972, and then we're back to 6000, which when it's combined with 62, gives you the 26,000 tail number. He went back in terms of numbering, so he would have an aircraft that says 2012. And no one until now has figured this out. Now that's not where it stops. In fact, that's just where it begins. Because if in fact this coincidence is more than a coincidence, you'd expect to have him more involved than the story goes. That he basically said to Jackie, you know, redesign the airplane. Well, this of course is incredibly ironic, because this was the last flight on this aircraft that these two individuals took. And that night, this aircraft brought him, because of this alignment, because of the politics behind all of this, that aircraft brought him back from his murder in Dallas to Washington. All because, I believe, he stepped outside the box and tried to include the other side of the planet in something that would destined to affect the entire history of the human species. And there were forces on both sides that could not countenance that, and they wound up sidelining both, killing Kennedy and basically putting Khrushchev under house arrest until he died. What's ironic is that Air Force One turns out to be a kind of an unsung witness to this unsung history. This is the flyover that the crew did at 1,000 feet over Arlington when the president was buried in 1963. Well, if you dig a little deeper, if you go a little deeper in this story, you find not only that this widow played an unusual role in the Kennedy administration. This headline I've always thought was incredibly interesting. Look at all the symbology wound up in that headline, including Magic 12, etc., etc., etc. However, known around the world for her sense of fashion, culture, and all the rest, we all understand that it was Jack who, with Ted White, just a week after Kennedy was killed, created out of nowhere apparently, the Camelot legend, the Camelot idea. But wait till you see what Camelot really means. It's all about King Arthur. King Arthur's court, Knights of the Round Table, and we all know the story. What you don't know is that Thucydides in Time magazine in 95 said, with clarity and political savvy of a master spin artist, a 34-year-old widow spoke to the writer Ted White 4 hours, urging him to tell the world through Life magazine that Kennedy was truly a man of magic. Another proverb. That his presidency was truly special. That the era was, to use the word she borrowed from a Broadway musical, one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot. Why would Jackie create that mythology? Well, because King Arthur turns out to be part of 2012. Oh, you're gonna love this. And there's someone else that turns out to be part of 2012, which is really gonna freak you out. You're only about 30 seconds away from finding out who, okay? The early Welsh and English people placed King Arthur's home in the constellation referred to as Ursa Major. This constellation was called Arthur's Wagon or Arthur's Wain. In the Lay Last Minstrel, the following phrase appears. Arthur's slow wain his horse doth pole in utter darkness round the pole. Well, this is why Arthur's Wain is crucial. Because the two end stars in the bowl of the Big Dipper point to Polaris, which is the pole star in the sky that marks the axial orientation in 2012 of where the North Pole intersects the sky. This is a 1800s representation of one of those gorgeous illustrated celestial catalogs of this. And this, of course, is what it's really referring to. Orbit around the sun, axis, precession, but the axis right now points to Polaris, which is right about there. Now, the Navy of the Army, evolving into the Air Force, set up this polar expedition stuff in the mid-1940s, 46, 47, 48. Both the Navy and the Army's projects were called Nanook. And, of course, Nanook refers to the bear, refers to the bear of the Great Dipper, the Big Dipper. The Great Bear refers to Arthur, refers to Camelot. Connect, 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 connect the dots. In politics, there is no such thing as a coincidence. So this is what it looks like if you were to plot it out. Here's the pole. This is Polaris. And you can simply step through this and see how, as the Earth rotates, and the stars turn around the celestial pole, the alignment between these two stars and the endpoint of the Earth's axis extending into space continues to coincide, coincide, coincide. There is a big board on a castle in England that is claimed to be Arthur's Round Table, In fact, it has, remember there were supposed to be 12 guys sitting at the round table, 12 knights? This one actually has 26 divisions. 26,000. You know, that's a few thousand here and there. And Hamlet's Mill, which is an excellent scholarly work by Grigori Donsinella and Hutta von Deschen, which goes into all these celestial processional mythologies all over the world, and we find they all are basically the same. They say the idea of a succession of worlds, the destruction of earth by flood or fire, and many stories of the fall of great kings and heroes are based on the disappearance of the pole star and its replacement by another due to the phenomena of precession. But in fact, a precession may be linked through the physics to the ends of these world ages and to what happens at the end, which, as we've said before, is not very pleasant. Mm-hmm. So, the whole idea of precession as being the determiner of human history itself is touched on by Hamlet's Mill, but they never get to the physics of it. Because they're looking at the legend part, and they're not understanding there is a actual physical process that could lead to upheavals as this processional cycle goes through these various moments, peak points, nodal points. Which, of course, brings us back to Camelot. Camelot, as we now can see, was even bigger than merely the idea of it was a wonderful time in politics in America. It was representative of that Arthurian ideal. If you look at the symbology underneath, it's another code. Underneath is conversion of Air Force One into a flying representation of what he was quietly, obviously, working on. It was a representation of the connection between earth and sky. And this, of course, is from Life magazine in 63. She talked about, you know, he was so excited by the Saturn rockets and all that, she wanted to write his name on the side of one of them. And, of course, McNamara, with the permission of Johnson, turned not only the Kennedy Space Center into his legacy, but also, for a brief period of time, Cape Canaveral itself was renamed Cape Kennedy. So as she says here, everything that went to the sky, I love the language, everything that goes to the sky from there had Kennedy's name on it. In other words, if you look at history, so much is symbolic. Understand what's going on, and the rest of us, of course, don't count. I'm sorry, but that's reality. The cool part is, with the internet now, we can all figure this stuff out, and we all can count. So, again, the reiteration of themes here is that something could be happening on December 21, 2012, or thereabouts, and every president from Truman forward appears to have somehow shared that information and has done at various levels something about it. And one guy who tried to do something about it, in fact, was murdered trying to do something. Which brings us to this. And the big question that I know is on all your minds, when is he going to get to the part where he tells us why Kennedy was killed and who did it? Okay, we're there. The hero of this part of the story turns out to be the president's own beloved special aircraft, Air Force One.
Mm.
Now, the color scheme that Jackie ostensibly set up continues to the present day. The tail numbers have changed as they've changed aircraft. It's no longer 26,000, I think it's now 20,000, 29,000. But the color scheme has remained exactly the same. So I got very interested in the connection between the color scheme and the aircraft tail number, and I started researching how did this transformation of the Air Force NAT aircraft come into being. Well, one of the key players was Raymond Loewy, who was a well-known, huge, well-known designer of the 50s and 60s. And the other player, of course, was Jackie. We've all heard the story, all heard the tale that Jackie, when she came into the White House, was appalled at how bad it had been preserved. And how it was, you know, she used the term, it was like an information from a bargain basement. Mm-hmm. So she began a campaign against Kennedy's wishes, by the way, up until it worked, to re-transform the White House, to refurbish it, to renovate it, to restore it, to where it would be truly a mansion worthy of the people in whose name it is inhabited. And there's all kinds of photographs and books written about Camelot redesigning, you know, you can look up on the web anything about this if you want, but looking at it with the right set of eyes is where the story lies. So one of the things we find out right away is that Jackie hired this designer, Sister Parrish, who, by the way, was not endowed with a predilection for rearranging furniture. Her real name was Dorothy. Somehow she got the name Sister in the middle there somehow. She was one of the preeminent interior designers of the 1950s and 60s. And Jackie turned to her and basically said, help me transform the White House into the place that I would like it to be. And so that's what they began. Now, at some point along the line, she made a deal with Henry DuPont, who was very wealthy and had access to an awful lot of antiques
and had
chains of connections that allowed him to talk to various people about antiques, and antiques that had been in the White House and had been sold on auction or on the open market and bring them back to the White House, or finding pieces that were exactly like pieces that had been in the White House in this historical period. So DuPont became a key ally. And then a third guy that they brought in was Stefan Bodine, who was head of Maison Jensen, which was the major Parisian, actually global, interior design firm. They had offices in the 30s, 40s, and 50s all over the world. Buenos Aires, China, you know, London, New York, everywhere. She turned to him to help her with this, and ultimately he wound up pushing out Sister Parrish, much to her very, very high dudgeon and display, which, again, you can read about over and over and over again. So far, this is kind of like an interior decorating sofa. What does this have to do with 2012? As part of her methodology of replacing the good stuff in the White House and redecorating it so that it all kind of matched and it communicated an historical grand message as well as being a home in which they live, she employed these people to redesign and radically reform. This was the Blue Room prior to, during the Truman and the Eisenhower years. This is the Blue Room that Bodine decorated. Apparently incredibly high marks in the fashion and interior design world. This is the Red Room during Truman and Eisenhower. This is the Red Room after Bodine got done with it. This is, I think, one of the upstairs sitting rooms that Parrish did. This is the sitting room after Parrish. And then we've got this group. This is the cabinet room. Now, I looked at this and I said, cabinet room. Why is that familiar? And then I realized why it looks familiar. Because this is the floor of a Masonic lodge. Bodine decorated Kennedy's cabinet room and the ceiling to match the Masonic temple ritual places of masons all over the world.
Goodness.
That, of course, got me really intrigued. Then, I look back at these casual shots of Kennedy in the Oval Office. The Oval Office, by the way, he inherited from Eisenhower, who in turn inherited it from Truman. So you're basically looking at the Truman Oval Office here, minus Truman and with Kennedy. And I got intrigued with the connection between the decor of the Oval Office and the decor of Air Force One, a la Raymond Foley. So I began digging and digging, and then finally, this year, we could not have done this until this year, because in February of this year, these people, the AIGA, which is the American Institute for Graphic Artists, published a piece by Paul Patton on the real Air Force One story. And what Patton did was to go back to original sources. Among other things, he went to the Hagia Museum of History, where all these papers are stored, and found the most amazing set of documents. Patton wondered who might have helped, who should also be incredible Air Force One design. What was the real inspiration? So he's thinking, he's thinking. He made a connection at the museum, this gal, Lynn Cantonese, and she sent him a whole bunch of stuff, including actual letters, typewritten by Lowy himself, archived in this museum, which is connected to DuPont. Big surprise. Which tells how the story of Air Force One came to be. And you can read it here, that Lowy first saw President Kennedy's Air Force NAC jet when Kennedy came to Palm Beach in one of his early campaign trips, right after he'd been elected, in the spring of 62, I guess. And this is the one where Frank Sinatra wanted to host him, and couldn't go near Frank Sinatra because of the mob connections. And Sinatra took a thread timer to the heliport that he built with his own hands. He was so unhappy. Which, of course, gets back to the whole mafia thing, Kennedy being killed and all that. I mean, this is a turgid soup. Getting to the bottom of the soup is almost impossible unless you have a good compass. Continuing with Patton's story, Lowy met with one of the president's key aides on that trip and basically said, you got a lousy airplane there for the president of the United States. Let me design one for you, and I'll give it to you. And that, apparently, is the real history of how Air Force One began. Because what Lowy did was he went to the White House in May of 62, turns out, and he presented the president with a series of options. And you can read here, he says, we rearranged the panels on the armchairs, the president without hesitation selected one of the graphics. His choice was the one that Lowy also preferred, and this is what Air Force One would look like in the Air Force regalia, except, this is critical, he picked the paint scheme, but he wanted it in blue, not red, because the president never liked red. In fact, he really, really didn't like red. And blue was his favorite color. So we get this incredibly regal jet. So then Lowy goes on in his typewritten notes. When he returned a few days later, he brought with him scissors and rubber paint. You should read rubber cement. Okay. This guy, whoever wrote this, didn't know how to, rubber cement. And Lowy set the stuff up on the floor. Kennedy's sitting in the rocker, the famous rocker, and he makes some suggestions and changes, and he's intimately involved in the process of redesigning his own airplane. Why is he involved? Because remember, in our model, Air Force One is a flying representation of 2012. 26,000 years for one cycle to complete. And this...
Two more, everybody.
You're supposed to embody. For instance, having the two colors of blue, what does that tell anybody? If they understand anything about celestial symbology, blue represents the sky. It represents the connection between the presidency, the sky, and the date. He couldn't have been telling us clear if he'd actually spoken it in plain language. I'm concerned about the world ending, and I'm going to do everything in my presidency to try to keep that from happening in 2012. We got this extraordinary aircraft. Timeless, classic, exquisite, tasteful even now. It does not look dated, does not look from the 60s. It could have been rolled off the Boeing assembly line yesterday. With, of course, this crucial tail number representing to anyone who knows, through this design, what Kennedy was really trying to do. And irony of ironies, Air Force One carried him to his final, final rest. So the death of Tavelot, the death of JFK, has within it all kinds of elements leading to where we can go now. Because when you go to the White House Museum, you find this curious set of statements. Bodine's renovations were not quite complete in the West Wing in November of 63 when President Kennedy was assassinated. The turnover was so rushed, Mrs. Kennedy never got a chance to see the final Oval Office. It was completed while the couple were literally in Dallas. And when the president was killed, they took everything out before she got back, so she never saw what Bodine planned and implemented in the Oval Office. Wait till you see. This is a president who is so at home, so comfortable. By the way, did he have back pain? This look like a guy with back pain?
No.
He's sitting in one of those captain's chairs. He had two captain's chairs arranged on both sides of the president's desk. This is the National Geographic logo behind him. This is the blue, green, teal Truman rug that Eisenhower just kept. The president gets $100,000 every year to redecorate the personal. Nobody used it from Truman up to Kennedy until Kennedy decided that Jackie would be able to do what she wanted with the White House. So here's a guy really at home in his office. I live in my office. I don't know how many of you spend 24/7 in front of your computer, but I live in my office. If I had something in my office that bothered me, I would change it because when your environment is so connected to your work, when you're there, when you're living and eating and breathing, basically the background that you are inhabiting, it becomes a really important expression of who you are. It must be in sync with who you are. The Oval Office had to be in sync with who John F. Kennedy was, which is why when I saw this picture, I said, oh my God, because this was his office, and this was what Bowden designed and put in place when they were gone. That brief weekend, this atrocious office became the Oval Office of the Presidency of the United States for a president who did not like red.
It's all red, everybody.
Now, as soon as I put this together, I said to myself, okay, who had the power with Jackie and Jack missing to order the Oval Office completely redone that weekend? And there was only one man, Lyndon Baines Johnson. And that Bodine was acting as his agent. That's the only thing that made sense. And Mike and I sat in front of the screen and I said to Mike, why don't you go to the White House thing? You know, his wife starts looking around, making calls. People freak out. Well, I had to get a little smart. I had to have other people do some digging for me. Well, Mike kind of got busy, you know, he's out there building spacecraft and Grumman and, you know, having a good social life in LA. And he never really got around to making a couple of calls to the history office. I found this, which was so endemic to my perception of Kennedy, having done the white paper on the web earlier last year, looking at this whole detente between these two gentlemen, which would have changed the world for the better if they had been allowed to proceed. And I'm looking at this comparison. I'm looking at, this is what Kennedy could live with up until 63. Obviously, he liked the blue. He loved the grapes. He loved the decor. He was so at home. You saw him in this chair, casual in his own office. This would have been such an anathema. Just from my own instinct, he could not have stood being in a room covered in blood.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And in the White House History Museum, it again reiterates that Kennedy did not see this because it was completed that weekend. He was in Dallas, and whoever had it done knew he would never be coming back.
That's right.
That he would never have to live in that office because it wasn't being designed for him. It was being designed for his successor, a guy who, in fact, did like red and kept the carpet up until the end of his first term. Oh, he did something else. Look at this. The rocker. That is the same rocker that Kennedy had.
Done.
It's been reupholstered. It's got new cushions. It's been refurnished. The old veneer taken off and the new whatever put on. But how do we know it's the same? If you look down here at the bevels here, and you look at the knobs, and you look at this. Same knobs, same bevel, the same rocket. His successor had to use the throne of the king who had been killed, who was his predecessor, who he could not stand. And he kept the purpose. So, when we look on Air Force One, we see, of course, this classic photograph taken of the swearing in, the blood spattered Jackie standing there in the suit that she was determined not to change for symbolic reasons. Does Sarah Hughes. There's a curious little footnote to history which Jim Mars, who right about now should be presenting the same data over at the assassination conference in Dallas, which I find eerie. He told me that the reason that everything got held up, Johnson wanted to be sworn in on Air Force One, but they had to wait 2 hours. And Sarah Hughes, when she finally showed up, they were lifelong friends, she said, I'm sorry, Lyndon, but I couldn't find a copy of the swearing-in ceremony for the president to assume, or the vice president to assume the duties of the president. And Lyndon reached inside his pocket and handed her a copy. There's a federal judge who spent 2 hours looking all over Dallas and couldn't find one, and Johnson had one to give to her. Then there's this photograph, taken moments after the other photograph. This is the head of the House Committee on Space, and there's Johnson, and he's winking at Johnson. And Johnson obviously is grinning or smiling or winking back at him. This guy was the one who introduced legislation in the House of Representatives forbidding the United States from cooperating with the Soviet Union in any lunar landings or activities unless there was a congressional vote, overwhelming positive vote in that direction. So why did Kennedy pick Johnson? Well, in this book written by Sally Bettel Smith, Grace and Power, there is this most extraordinary set of references. Johnson told Claire Booth Luce, who you know was the wife of the guy who founded the Life magazine and Time magazine and all that, she told him that he could find a rationale for accepting the vice presidency because he said, I looked it up, and one out of every four presidents has died in office. I'm a gambling man, darling, and this is the only chance I got. That is on the record. And a bunch of other stuff. But the most telling piece of information to me is the color of that rug. And the fact that Bodine had decorated the cabinet room and the Oval Office, however, when his reservation was not quite...
One more.
He completed that weekend. Now, here's the important link. In the commission of a crime, there are three things that every prosecutor looks for. Means, motive, and opportunity. And one of the means is, are the players supposed to embody? For instance, having the two colors of blue, what does that tell anybody? If they understand anything about celestial symbology, blue represents the sky. It represents the connection between the presidency, the sky, and the date. He couldn't have been telling us clear if he'd actually spoken it in plain language. I'm concerned about the world ending, and I'm going to do everything in my presidency to try to keep that from happening in 2012. We got this extraordinary aircraft. Timeless, classic, exquisite, tasteful even now. It does not look dated, does not look from the 60s. It could have been rolled off the Boeing assembly line yesterday. With, of course, this
number
crucial
14,
tail number representing to anyone who knows.
Yeah.
Through this design.
Sorry, there we go.
It's supposed to embody. For instance, having the two colors of blue, what does that tell anybody? It represents the connection between...
Well, try it again.
I think we might be at the end.
Hit 14. No, no. It wasn't done.
Oh, okay.
There, 14. Leave it alone.
He completed it that weekend. Now, here's the important link. In the commission of a crime, there are three things that every prosecutor looks for. Means, motive, and opportunity. And one of the means is, are the players connected? Well, it turns out that Bodine had been the guy to redecorate the French-style mansion in Washington that was bought by Lyndon Johnson. The old Pearl Mesa estate. Now, the reason that's important is because if you look at this connection of personnel, it means that Johnson knew Bodine. He could pick up the phone and say, I want this, this, and this done. And Bodine likely had more connections we're not aware of, because at that level, there's a lot of things that are connected. And so he carried out orders. It was not Jackie Bodine. Jackie knew her president so well, she would never, ever have countenanced Red. And she never got to see it. Remember, it was all taken down before she got back to the White House after Kennedy was killed in Dallas. So it all was done without her knowledge as well. By the time she walked in, obviously, if she ever did do it, we don't even know if she ever visited the Oval Office after he was killed. That would be something interesting to track down. The point is that the same guy who put a Masonic pattern on the floor of Kennedy's cabinet room is the same guy who redesigned the Oval Office and then implemented it. The nexus of this, the connection is that John Kennedy himself set up the antithesis between those who would control the presidency from outside and the president being the president of the United States himself. In a speech in May, in 1962, the same week, by the way, that he was redesigning Air Force One, he said this. Now, I know there are some people who say that this, we're talking about the steel crisis, is no business of the President of the United States, who believe that the President should be an honorary chairman of a great fraternal organization and confine himself to ceremonial functions. But that is not what the Constitution said. And I did not run for President of the United States to fulfill that office that way. So I believe that what got Kennedy killed is he also made enemies of the same people that we have documented in Dark Mission are in fact Masonic up to their eyebrows. That in fact are a great fraternal organization seeking to control the destiny of the human species to the point that they sent a Masonic flag to the moon in July of 1969, which was then brought back by this guy, an astronaut you might remember named Aldrin, and presented to a guy named Smith who happened to be running the Grand Temple in Washington, D.C. of the Supreme Council 33, which is just up the street from the White House at 1733 16th Street. And Robin and I have been there and photographed it in some detail. This is what it looks like if you stand in front of it. These are Egyptian goddesses and gods. This is Osiris and Isis. And of course, this is what it looks like at night. The White House is just down this street a few blocks away. And if you remember the film, The Day the Earth Stood Still, there's a shot. Remember when all the power is cut and for half an hour nobody can do anything? There's a shot in that film of the temple by Robert Weiss. What is the meta message Robert Weiss is trying to tell us about the influence of the Masonic people that run this temple in Washington in that film, which is all about how the world is being run and mismanaged, and that even when an alien comes and tries to get us to make peace with each other, he is shot and then killed. Eerie foreshadowing. And this, of course, is an aerial shot showing the fact that our nation's capital is filled with Masonic symbols. This is a huge Egyptian obelisk right outside the south lawn of the White House. And this, of course, is the Jefferson Memorial. Well, this president, John Kennedy, said this is going to end. I will be president of all the people. I will not let secret organizations and corporations and others try to tell me how to run the business of the United States, and we have no idea how much more he meant than is on the public record, except from the symbology. The fact that this agency, in what it was planning to do, was, as Mike and I documented, was most threatened. Oh, by the way, his first head of NASA, 33rd degree Mason. Which you can see if you go to any Masonic site, you can see all the names of all the key players. This is not a complete list, by the way. It needs to be updated. So bottom line, one of the key enemies that John Kennedy had in what he was trying to do, whatever it was obviously the Nazis in this agency. Because there were Nazis in this agency. Who were they? Well, we know who they were. We know that space was so important because it was Wernher von Braun who basically connected with Kennedy in architecting the entire Apollo program. The same Wernher von Braun who, of course, is an SS officer, a lieutenant in the SS in Hitler's brigade. Mm-hmm. And all of the guys, the von Braun, according to Operation Paperclip, brought with him to the United States from Germany after the war, all of them were ardent Nazis. You look at their dossiers, it's astonishing that they were allowed to work under any administration, let alone this administration. Because, of course, the Germans and the Russians didn't get along, and you can imagine how they felt, just as Germans, but Germans. The fact that this guy was and it all comes back to that love. But the other thing you need to know, Berdine, among his clients, worked for the German Reichsbank during the era of the Nazis. Adolf Hitler personally asked him to redecorate the interior of the German Reichsbank, which, by the way, historically, looks like this and has this interesting claim to fame. The German Reichsbank was the biggest counterfeiter. They tried to literally do what has been done now by the banking system, to crash the global economy of the Allies by printing up billions of dollars of fake counterfeit money. Right. It all came through this bank, which Stefan Bodine was the designer for under Adolf Hitler when Hitler personally asked him to redesign the bank's interior. Which then leads us to Jim Marsworth. I strongly recommend that you read Jim Marsh, because what we're looking at here is a pattern toward global fascism. A pattern that we see disturbingly in our own society over the last 46 years since John Kennedy was in fact killed. A pattern which goes back to the Kennedy assassination, and there is this astonishing summation by Laura Knight, who says that in the end, what has ruled America for the past 43 years, she wrote this in 2006, is a corrupt government that took power on November 22nd in a coup d'etat that worked from the day forward toward the goal of turning the United States of America into a fascist machine for world conquest, i.e. the New World Order. A New World Order which is in front of this ticking Mayan clock, which has been obviously known and paid attention to ever since in the 40s, Harry Truman, through his SAC, Strategic Air Command, figured out that something radical was coming and that something had to be done. A something which is exemplified by this man and this aircraft, leading, of course, to NASA's own secret mission to go to the moon and maybe bring back something that would help us change what is to come. Leaving us with the final question. What does Barack Obama do? Thank you.
Thank you.
always.
Very persevering, everybody. What does old Barack Obama know? The shadow knows too. There's a light a-coming to the light land.
Are you here, Dad?
Lady Master? Hello? Did we get you in another dimension? Lady Master Beth?
Green.
I thought
green.
There you are. That was pretty interesting, and I would just say that we are shapeshifters, all of us now. And this hyperdimensional physics, we're immersed in it now. We really are. Hyperspace. What is that again, Robin?
Hyperdimensional physics.
Yeah, and I mean the hyperspace thing.
That's different.
It is?
Yeah. I believe.
Look at there.
Not so different.
Yeah. Not so different.
No.
No. I just know that we're really getting our wings for quantum leaps here.
Yeah.
I really, really am glad that we did listen to that because, of course he knows. Of course he knows. He, leaves the answer still into some wider parameters of speculation, you might say. Yet, I wanted to read one more thing because it's very short and it really does to me depict what Richard Holden was saying in a very wide span. And because we're approaching the day out of time very rapidly, I think this would really help us. It's called the law of time. The law of time is a universal law and principle. It states that time is the universal factor of synchronization. The law of time distinguishes between a natural timing frequency that governs the universal order and an artificial timing frequency which sets modern human civilization apart from the rest of its environment, the biosphere. The effect of basing a civilization on artificial timing factors, an irregular calendar, and the mechanical clock has resulted in the creation of an artificial global mantle, the technosphere. By consuming natural resources faster than they can be replaced and creating more waste, than can be eliminated. The technosphere operates at the expense of the biosphere, hence the current global crisis. The law of time affirms that all of the planetary upheaval and social chaos that we are experiencing today are directly related to giving precedence to human laws and machine technology rather than divine order and natural law. This is due to living a collective misperception of time, known as the 1260 frequency. This refers to the 12-month cycle of the irregular Gregorian calendar paced by the 60-minute clock. Living in an artificial time disconnects us both as a species and individually from our true nature. We always feel as though we never have time enough. In the 1260 frequency, time is money. In the 1320 frequency, time is art. Sounds like our Cynthia whispering here in the ear. The 1320 ratio of the natural timing frequency coded into the Dolkin, the 260-unit harmonic matrix. The 1320 frequency can also be found in our body. We have 13 main articulations and 20 fingers and toes. The law of time affirms that by the nature of the universal timing frequency, the world is already as one. It is only humankind who has chosen separation. This separation is reinforced by separation in time, living by the clock, and the irregular measure of the Gregorian calendar keeps the world from being as one. Now that is really exactly on the nose, that they created that Gregorian calendar to keep the world from being as one. The law of time states, energy factored by time equals art. In this equation, E refers to all phenomena in their processes of unfolding. T is the present moment, functioning according to the ratio constant 1320. Everything shaped by time is art. Time times energy equals art. This is that cool, everybody. So what are we going to do for the art music here? Beth, is there something you want to share?
I really enjoyed Richard Hoagland's piece. He surmises it in a way no one else does, and to hear him speaking of our current president this way and bringing that to light is so wonderful. There's a lot of wisdom there.
And you know, after listening to Keith Olbermann and to see that when you take the pendulum as far as you can to one extreme, which one are you going to do next? Okay. It comes back to the balance. And you know, Rama just pointed to the Wolf Medicine song by Shenandoah. And that's what Wolf Medicine is, a great teacher of balance in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you know, they have a wisdom. They have such a presence. We've had the honor of spending lots and lots of time with lots and lots of wolves, since we've come to Santa Fe together. Mm-hmm. We have a friend, our wolf man, and, 7 wolves there that we got to know very, very well. And then our friend Kip Dixon, 4 more wolves. And I mean, they don't forget you. We would be gone for a year or two and we'd come back and visit and they knew exactly where we left off. And so here we go. Let's say it's 3:02 enough. Anything more, anybody?
Well, that reminds me of Grandmother Twyla. She comes from the Wolf Clan.
Oh, yes, she did. And Grandmother Twyla got into the Porpoise Fund. We got her to get into the Porpoise Fund.
Wow.
Yes.
And did she talk to Mother, too?
Yes, she did.
She did. I went to see her in Florida at the Wolf Clan gathering. That's crazy.
I mean, we are ready now, everybody. All right, we better say aloha. And I love you all so much. Thank you for your perseverance.
Namaste.
Namaste. Thank you.
Beautiful. They just did a wonderful little short on the wolf medicine. All different energy. Thank you, everyone. See you
thank
in the
night. Thank you so much, everybody.
Oh, yes, thank you. Namaste. See you mañana.
Namaste.
Namaste.